All right, we'll call the Health and Human Services Committee meeting to order, the Reform Committee meeting to order this morning. We'll start with Representative Albright moving the minutes from February 23rd, 2017. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes from February 23rd, 2017, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted for February 23rd, 2017. First up this morning, we have House File 1371, Representative Peterson. And Representative Peterson moves that House File 1371 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have the bill in front of us, Representative Peterson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I also would like to just move the A1 amendment, which makes it so that this bill is effective the day following final enactment.
All right. To get the bill into the order in which the author wishes to present it, Representative Peterson moves the A1 amendment. Any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Peterson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1371 is a simple bill that will simply save lives. It provides for the addition of 21 child and adolescent psychiatric beds at the Brooklyn Park location of Prairie Care. There is a website that you can check to see what available beds are available in the state of Minnesota, and as of today, there were no beds available anywhere in Minnesota for children needing admission to a psych unit. In fact, Prairie Care turns away 5 children a day. You know, I'm here to answer any questions. As you can see, that there's quite a bit of support from members in your packet, and there is no opposition that I'm aware of, and I do have Dr. Oberstar here who can also add some few comments.
All right, Dr. Oberstar, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Joel Oberstar. I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist and CEO of Prairie Care, and I'm very pleased to have this opportunity to make some very brief remarks. I know you have a great many items on your agenda this morning. House File 1371 authorizes Prairie Care to add 21 beds to our 50-bed inpatient hospital in Brooklyn Park, allowing us to serve approximately 750 additional youth each year. We propose to accomplish this by adding second beds to 21 of our rooms, creating a mix of single and double occupancy services that are indeed the standard of care in our community for psychiatrically hospitalized youth. The need for these beds to meet the needs of Minnesota's youth is clear. As I was discussing this committee meeting with a colleague, he shared a story of a teenager who had been sent home from an emergency department right here in the Twin Cities with stitches in both wrists and both legs because no inpatient beds were available. Thankfully, he was able to be hospitalized a few days later. Minnesota families shouldn't have to monitor their kids on a 24-hour suicide watch at home while awaiting inpatient care. Our kids deserve better. I could go on and on all morning, but I will spare you that and just close by simply saying I'm very thankful that we have seen great support for our proposal all across the healthcare system, and particularly thankful to Representative Peterson for carrying this bill, and also want to thank the 20 members of this committee that have co-authored this legislation. It's refreshing to see legislators from both parties and from all across the state of Minnesota coming together to address this pressing public health crisis. And with that, I would be available for questions if you have
them. All right. Thank you, Dr. Oberstar, for your testimony this morning. Are there questions for Dr. Oberstar? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning. Thank you. So, Representative Peterson, I think that the Department of Health had to do a review. And I'm looking in the packet. I'm not seeing anything here. Certainly there's a lot of support from a lot of different corners on the bill, but could you just address that piece of it?
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Representative Liebling, and Mr. Chair. Thanks for bringing that up. We submitted a review so that 90-day window expired on February 12th, and to this day, so 3 weeks later after that time period expired, we still have not received that yet.
Representative Liebling.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I hope the Department of Health is going to testify, because I would like to. In fact, when I signed on the bill, I told the lobbyist that I was signing on provisionally, assuming that the Department of Health was going to approve it, and I certainly am not seeing any opposition here in what we have. I do have another question, and I see Mr. Gildemeister's coming down, but maybe in the meantime, one of the two testifiers could answer this. I was told that Prairie Care does take Medicaid, but then I also was told that some of the major HMOs that are doing PMAP are not providers for Prairie Care. Could you clarify that? What insurance or, you know, what public insurance does Prairie Care accept?
Dr. Oberstar.
Representative Liebling, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to offer some comments on that question. This question has come up many times over the years. Prairie Care runs a Joint Commission accredited inpatient hospital in Brooklyn Park. We are MCALA obligated. We are participating. We participate in Medicare and Medicaid, and are in-network providers for almost all major payers in the state of Minnesota, with the exception of one.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Testifier. Could you be a little more specific and tell us who that is, and maybe you can tell us, if you can, why that is?
Dr. Oberstar.
Representative Liebling, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to share that news. It was in the paper about a year and a half ago. We have been in-network with Medica as an in-network provider, and we're unable to come to terms primarily regarding utilization review and utilization management with that payer, and elected to go out of network at that point.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I'm glad I asked, because I was under the impression that it was UCARE. That's what somebody had told me. So I take it that was wrong.
Representative Liebling, Mr. Chairman. Yes, we are in network with UCARE, and I would add one additional piece that I think it's important for the committee to understand. As an MCALA obligated hospital, Prairie Care accepts patients for admission to our facility from emergency departments without regard to their ability to pay. That fact is sometimes lost because we do not have an emergency department, but as a specialty psychiatric hospital, two questions we inquire when a patient is referred to us from an emergency department essentially are, do they have an emergency psychiatric condition for which inpatient admission is necessary, and do we have the capacity and capability to provide care? Answer to the first question is almost always yes, they do have an emergency psychiatric condition. The answer to the second question, unfortunately, is frequently no. We do not have capacity or capability because our building is full, just like most of the other units in the state. And that's the reason for this bill.
Mm-hmm. Representative Liebling.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Oberstar. And would it be okay if Mr. Gildemeister comes up and tells us about the Department of Health?
Mr. Gildemeister, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and help Representative Liebling with her question.
Mr. Chair, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. I direct the health economics program at the Department of Health, and our group generally is responsible for conducting reviews under the public interest review process. And to answer Representative Liebling's question, we're about a week out of completing the review for this proposal.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Gildemeister. Well, that's kind of unfortunate timing here, I guess, but certainly the bill won't get to the floor before that point. But can you give us any information? I mean, we've got here a stack of letters from different organizations that are saying, yes, yes, we need this. And I certainly haven't heard anything to the contrary. Can you tell us that does it look like the Department of Health is going to say yes?
Mr. Gildemeister.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, you know, when I've come before you, I've always wanted you to have complete information. I understand, of course, the legislature's timeline and process. Let me say this preliminarily. We don't see anything in the proposal that makes it not be in the public interest either at this point. But that's a preliminary assessment, so please consider that.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for either Mr. Gildemeister or Dr. Oberstar? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1371? Any final questions for the bill author? Final word, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a great bill that will help address the needs that we have in our psychiatric pediatric area. Thank you.
All right, and with that, Representative Peterson renews her motion that House File 1371, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and House File 1371, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Next up this morning, we have House File 1229, Representative Pearson. And as he makes his way forward, I will move that House File 1229 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Pearson, we have the bill in front of us. When you're ready, please present your bill.
Life-changing work here today, folks. This is mostly a technical bill for the Office of the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. This is really just updating some language of some of the services that have been provided over the last 20 years, and just changing it so we get better understanding of access to clients' information, and doing some minor changes of definitions. So with that, I have Roberta Opheim here with me today, and she can give some more information.
All right, and Representative Pearson, you have the A1 amendment. Do you wish the A1 amendment
to move? Oh, I do wish to move the A1.
All right, I'll move the A1 amendment. Representative Pearson, to your amendment.
The amendment is in working with the department and NAMI and others. This is just clarifying some language for better understanding.
All right, are there any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Pearson, to your bill as amended.
I have Roberta Opheim here to give further guidance.
Ms. Opheim, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roberta Opheim. I am the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, that also incorporates chemical dependency and emotional disturbance in children. So we cover a broad range of individuals, and we're there to help resolve issues or check the quality of the program to ensure that the mechanisms that are in place are working. Over the years, our office has been in existence for 30 years and have very minorly changed things along the way. So this is, for the most part, the same language, the base language, the same language we've always had. Because of the changing nature in the service delivery system, where more and more individuals who have traditionally fallen under the term client within our office are moving into settings that may or may not be licensed, or the housing may not be licensed, but the services might be, or neither the housing or the services are licensed. And there's a variety of reasons that's happening. Some in recognition of changes at the federal level, and some in recognition of just sort of the cost containment that's going on within the system, or more independent living. We've asked to clarify that it isn't just the old traditional facility, that includes certified programs, registered programs like the Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, which is not a licensed service. It's spelled out in law and it's certified, but it's not reviewed by licensing. It's reviewed by the policy department and without the same rigor that licensing does. The second thing is to tweak a few definitions. Mostly these are to clarify based on questions we routinely get from providers, and we have, decided that it's better to answer them. We wanted to include concussion protocols because you don't have to have a loss of consciousness in order to have a closed head injury. And, you know, we're reminding people that concussion precautions and assessment are important. In the section about access to records, we've gone back and forth with a number of individuals on this, including NAMI, and so the amendment reinserted some language about consent for those who are capable. There is no definition of capable that we can find, but I think we all generally have the concept of what capable means. It might mean a guardian, but it also might mean somebody who's in an extreme relapse state and isn't in a position to give consent. So we reinserted that. However, we have never been required to have releases from the developmentally disabled, so we reinserted that and added clients receiving services at the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And that is because that is the most closed institution we have, the most opportunity for subtle abuse and neglect. And now that the Eighth Circuit has ruled that it's constitutional, which I think we're all glad of, but there's been some change in the tone and temper, and we feel we need to be able to go in there without playing a lot of verbal gymnastics over data access. We always ask the client, again, if they're capable, do you want us involved? If they don't want us involved, we don't go in. So it's just adding that one program. And then the Civil Commitment Training and Resource Center is just to simply state what has existed for over 20 years. This body gave us the funding for it 20 years ago, but the chair forgot to insert the language. So we're just clarifying that. And then the last one is changing our advisory committee from a fiduciary board to what it really is, which is an advisory board. And it affects how they're appointed and when their terms end. So we feel it's fairer to have them under the advisory because they don't spend any money, they don't control any money, and they advise our office on what to do, but they don't have regulatory authority over us other than advisory capacity. So that's the bill as amended at this point. I would bring up, someone just pointed out to me after negotiating that if the author would agree that there would be three minor amendments, verbal amendments, if the author agrees. It was pointed out to me that I forgot to correct some language on 4.1 and 2, where it says strikes out with developmental disabilities.
Ms. Opheim, this bill does have further stops, and amendment would be, those amendments would be more appropriate.
That would be great. I'll be glad to do them then.
Be in writing then and make it a little bit more clear.
Okay. Happy to do it.
All right. Does that conclude your testimony?
That concludes my testimony, except right. I stand for questions.
All right. Are there any questions for Ms. Opheim? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1229? All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you. Shannon Mulvihill with Mental Health Minnesota, representing the Mental Health Legislative Network. I'll be very brief because I know you have a very big agenda today. We just wanted to note that the last thing that Roberta was mentioning about those last two amendments are concerns that we do have because they do expand the limiting the ability for people to give consent considerably. So we just wanted to make sure that got on the record that we're very concerned about that and would like that to move forward as an amendment in the future.
All right. Questions for Ms. Mulvihill, Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand this is something that's going to get corrected, but I'm not exactly tracking what it is, and I'd like to be a little bit more clear about
sure.
what it is that's the problem and what's going to be fixed. Could you just explain this?
I can. I think I tried to be too brief. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative. We have raised some concerns around some of the changes that have been made to the ability of clients to give consent. Most of those were addressed in the amendment, but two of them were not. And that is on what Roberta had referred to on line 4.2 and 4.5, because with that deleted language, that does expand the ombudsman's ability to act without consent of the client. And so those are the pieces we'd like to see addressed.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to clarify.
Any other questions for Ms. Mulvihill? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1229? Seeing none, any final questions for the bill author? Final word, Representative Pearson.
No, I just want to say the Ombudsman has done a great job in this area and is a great advocate for those in need of mental health in the state of Minnesota.
I think it's a uniquely positioned job in that she has oversight of departments without being within the department, and that's why this language gets a little bit bogged down in understanding for people. So I appreciate the assistance of the committee members in getting these changes made in the law.
All right, with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1229, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails on House File 1229, as amended, as referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Next, another Representative Pearson bill, House File 1186. And I will move that House File 1186 be referred to the General Register. Representative Pearson, we have the bill in front of us. To your bill.
Good morning, members. And House File 1186 is really addressing the access and shortages of mental health practitioners in the state of Minnesota. If I remember right, we do have an A1 here, too.
Yes, and I will move the A1 amendment, Representative Pearson, to the A1 amendment.
Just getting working with all the partners in this, just getting the language up to where we want it to be.
All right, are there any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Pearson, to your bill as amended.
Well, and again, here we're talking about just making some modifications to some training programs, and again, my testifiers are probably better served in fully explaining the details of it, but really changing some requirements in settings where there's a lot of oversight currently in order to provide a mostly like a new surge of staff for some of these desperately needed areas of practice. So go ahead and...
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Schumacher. My name is Kirsten Anderson. I'm with Aspire Minnesota. We are a membership association of about 40 providers across the state of Minnesota serving children, youth, and families who are receiving therapeutic interventions across the continuum of services: child welfare, children's mental health, juvenile justice, and homeless youth services. This morning we're bringing this bill before you after much discussion with stakeholders around the workforce shortage that we have in our mental health sector. This is a narrowly proposed bill that looks at mental health practitioners and day treatment settings for children. So in this fully supervised setting, mental health practitioners would be able to obtain the 2,000 hours of clinical supervised experience required to be licensed as a mental health practitioner for that and other settings in the future. So although it's a narrow definition that you're seeing before you, we anticipate that it'll have more significant impacts in the future as we're helping to grow the workforce. In addition, the bill speaks to consistent training and application of restrictive procedures by staff in those same settings, updates and clarifies some language related to a bulletin recently offered by DHS on treatment planning and having that reimbursed as part of our benefit for children's therapeutic services and supports. And finally, adds a clarifying area of adding the PRTFs, psychiatric residential treatment facilities, as part of those facilities that are able to provide some transition support for mental health with children. So with that, I'll give it to Heather McMoore.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Heather McMoore. I'm a mental health professional and have managed a day treatment program at the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation for 14 years. The Wilder Foundation is a member organization of Aspire Minnesota. Day treatment programs are certified by the Department of Human Services to provide intensive service to children and their families. The children and youth who receive day treatment service experience serious mental health conditions that significantly impact their ability to regulate their emotions and behavior, and this prevents them from functioning successfully at home, at school, and in the community. Common issues for children and youth in day treatment programs are anxiety, depression, hyperactivity and inattention, post-traumatic stress, and developmental delays. Children and youth receive up to 15 hours a week of therapy and skills development service, which is provided by mental health professionals and bachelor's level mental health practitioners. At Wilder, we serve 30 children a year. I continue to be impressed by how day treatment supports can equip children to increase their ability to regulate their emotions and behavior so that they can remain at home and function successfully at home, school, and in the community in ways similar to their same-age peers. Parents, sometimes for the first time, report feeling hopeful for their children's future and in their ability to effectively parent their children. Hiring qualified staff is one of the greatest challenges. I have never seen staff shortages impact service delivery so significantly. There are many occasions across the state where services are not provided to children in need simply because we do not have the staff. I strongly recommend allowing individuals with bachelor's degrees in relevant fields to obtain the required supervision while working in day treatment programs. Extensive observation, coaching, direction, and oversight by a bachelor's level staff is provided on-site by mental health professionals. Passing HF 1186 will allow more children and youth to receive this necessary service. It will allow programs to hire more diverse staff that reflect the populations we serve, and it will result in an increased workforce of mental health practitioners that will be available to work in other service areas once they have obtained the required supervision. Also, because staff and day treatment programs are so closely supervised by mental health professionals, I strongly recommend that all staff who are fully trained in use of restricted procedures be allowed to use procedures such as physical escorts and physical restraints to support children in emergency situations. Thank you for allowing me to provide this testimony.
All right. Thank you, Ms. McMorrow, for your testimony this morning. Are there questions for the testifiers? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not even really sure how to ask or what to ask here, but would like, if the testifiers could, just kind of give a clearer picture of, so right now, I just want to understand fully what the bill is doing. So right now, is it that if a person doesn't have the 2,000 hours, you can't bill for their services? I assume that that's what's going on here. I mean, they could come and work under supervision, but they can't. Can't bill their services separately? Am I misunderstanding?
We can't hire them to provide the skills service. They must have the 2,000 hours of supervision by a mental health professional to be able to be hired as a mental health practitioner. So with in most bachelor's level programs, when people have internships, et cetera, they're not provided supervision by mental health professionals. Organizations don't have the capacity to use mental health professionals that way, so we're unable to fill those positions to deliver the skills service.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you can't hire them to fill a position as a mental health practitioner if they don't have this additional training just based on their bachelor's degree, is what you're saying. You can't hire them as a mental health practitioner. But I guess I would say it sounds like they're not a mental health practitioner if they don't have that training. I get the workforce problem.
In day treatment programs, there is a mental health professional on site virtually all of the time. To give in the moment oversight and supervision. So in this very intensive, highly supervised programming by mental health professionals, we're requesting that requirement of the supervised practice prior to hiring be waived in this situation.
Representative Liebling.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess it raises a little concern for me, and I hope we're going to hear more from some other people in the room who might have more experience with this. I kind of harken back to my daughter a few years ago worked for an agency. It wasn't actually day treatment, it was inpatient for disturbed adolescents.
and she had a bachelor's degree in one of these fields, and but was not a mental health practitioner, and you know, kind of, and they employed a lot of people like her. I don't know. I'm just kind of concerned about how this is working. I get that we have these severe workforce shortages. I hope, though, that that doesn't mean that we're decreasing our standards for what it means to be a mental health practitioner. And I hope that I also am kind of interested in how this impacts the funding, because I was just looking again at the legislative auditor's report on home and community-based services and how much the state spends. And could you just clarify, is this funded as part of home and community-based services under Medicaid?
Ms. Anderson.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Liebling, I'm sorry, I didn't fully hear your question.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this funded as part of home and community-based services under Medicaid?
Ms. Anderson.
Chair. No, this is its own mental health section. So this is under the CTSS area, day treatment, and then we have defined in statute what a mental health practitioner is. And specifically, this seeks to only redefine as it relates to day treatment services. I'll also mention that there is ongoing training that is offered to all of our staff, especially mental health practitioners, especially as they enter the field. And the reason we define this so narrowly is because this setting is so much of a team environment, so that there are many folks who are able to mutually support one another. Ms. McMoore was sharing with me how they actually don't necessarily divide up caseloads, but they have a full team approach at all time. And so we have no interest in putting anyone in a circumstance where they don't have the required experience. But we do observe that this is an excellent environment where we can have these professionals serve as practitioners in this case, continue to receive training as they are on the job, and help to address the critical workforce shortage that we're facing across the state of Minnesota.
Ms. McMoore, any follow-up with that?
No.
All right. Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I'm certainly not accusing you of wanting to put anyone in a situation that isn't adequate for their needs. And I assume that this affects a lot of different treatment programs, and it's great to have a team approach. I'm all for that. I think probably most people probably think that's the best way to go. Certainly, you know, having Mayo Clinic in my district, I'm certainly a proponent of a team approach. That's what Mayo Clinic is. But I don't know. Are you able to say that all of the programs where this would apply are going to be using a team approach?
Day treatment services deliver the majority of the services through group therapy and group skills. And because of the intensity of issues children are receiving, we have high ratios of staff to children. Staff are rarely alone with children delivering group skills, the group skills that the mental health practitioners would be delivering. And typically, there are other mental health practitioners that are delivering that group service that have obtained the 2,000 hours of supervised experience by the mental health professional. So this is an initial structure to help people new to the teams come in that may have had years worth of supervised practice in mental health in educational settings, but just not been supervised by a mental health professional.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope we'll get some testimony from some other folks on this so we can get a little comfort on it from some others. Thanks.
All right. Any other questions for these particular testifiers? Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers,
hold your horses.
Thank you. Would this piece of legislation also allow for the people coming in with their bachelor's degree, would they then be getting the 2,000 hours of training by serving with the staff?
Yes, they would be. For full-time staff, those 2,000 hours would be obtained within their first year of employment.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions for these testifiers? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Ms. Averholden, I see you're making your way down here. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Averholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And because the question was asked, I just wanted to let you know that the Mental Health Legislative Network, which is a group of 40 organizations, did recommend to approve this bill and to support this bill. There were many changes that were made to actually alleviate some of our concerns about it by specifically stating it really in some ways exactly what degree someone had to have, because we wanted to make sure that there was some relevance to this issue. And because it's in a group setting versus in-home services, we felt more comfortable with this, and we do really recognize the huge workforce shortage. So this was definitely a collaborative effort, and the group really did try to address everyone's concern in the Mental Health Legislative Network.
All right, questions for Ms. Averholden? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm Dr. Tricia Stark, representing the Minnesota Psychological Association. I'm a licensed psychologist. Like Representative Liebling, we initially had really some concerns about changing the definition of mental health practitioner. But in light of the workforce issues that we are experiencing in Minnesota, we believe that a day treatment setting is secure enough and has enough staffing that it's permissible. We're not particularly supportive of changing the definition of mental health practitioner, but we do want to allow these people to be able to get their supervision, and we know that these positions need to be filled. So, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Stark, for your testimony. Other questions for Dr. Stark? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1186? Seeing none, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Hi, I'm Steve Gerardo. I'm a psychologist, and I am concerned about solving workforce issues with reducing the requirements for somebody to do psychotherapy. And I think that's the thing that no one's really addressing here, is that under this act, the practitioners can do psychotherapy without any real training. I understand the workforce issues. I worked my way up through the university hospital and did all of the things along the way, did my practicums, did my internship. And I understand that there are workforce issues, and those workforce issues are related to financing. It's difficult to be able to pay people enough to be able to have them do the work when they're qualified. But having people that are underqualified providing services that include psychotherapy to some of the most vulnerable clients in the state is a concern to me.
All right. Are there questions for Dr. Giraldo? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony. Are there any questions for the bill author? All right, final word, Representative Pearson.
I think I do have someone that maybe wants to offer one point of clarification on the bill.
All right, what are your final word?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, simply to clarify, this is a very narrow provision that simply speaks to children's day treatment settings. There is no offering of psychotherapy by this level of practitioner in children's day treatment settings. This is a skill-building opportunity, and it's a great opportunity for us through this bill to enhance our workforce, to build skills with young people so that they are able to be successful in school, in the community, with their families, and launch into a lifetime of success. So with that.
All right.
And my final word would be, again, I think we're identifying a bottleneck and an opportunity to train and grow the workforce to get more people through that needed a corridor. So appreciate your consideration.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1186, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1186, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Pearson. Next up this morning, we have House File 1258, Representative Heintzman. As Representative Heintzman is making his way down, I will move that House File 1258 be referred to Health and Human Service Finance. Representative We have the bill in front of us. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, members. In 2007, in an effort to increase access to certain mental health services for low-income Minnesotans, a rate increase was passed for certain mental health services if they were provided in a specific setting, including those settings that demonstrated a commitment to serving low-income and underserved populations by meeting specific requirements. In an effort to further increase access to mental health services for low-income Minnesotans, HF 1258 aims to broaden the settings that would qualify for this rate increase for these specific mental health services. I will now turn to my testifier for information on the bill.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Chair Schumacher and committee members, my name is Brian Nystrom. I'm the president and CEO, as well as practicing clinician at Nystrom & Associates. Nystrom & Associates provides mental health and chemical dependency services throughout the state of Minnesota, and has done so for the past 26 years. Services are provided at 11 Minnesota locations and out in the community. These services include child, adolescent, adult psychiatry, outpatient psychotherapy, psychological and neuropsychological testing, co-occurring intensive chemical dependency treatment for adolescents and adults, and various certified community-based programs for Minnesotans with serious and persistent mental illness. All of our programs are licensed by the Minnesota Department of Human Services. We employ over 900 employees. Of those, about 650 are mental health and chemical dependency clinicians, which allow us to provide these services for those seeking help and treatment. In calendar year 2016, we saw a total of 46,746 unique patients who resided in 83 different Minnesota counties. Nystrom & Associates accepts all insurance types, including fee-for-service medical assistance and prepaid medical assistance plans. Nearly 65% of the patients we serve in our outstate offices and 50% of our metro offices have fee-for-service medical assistance or a prepaid medical assistance plan. As Representative Heinzelman stated, the rate increase for mental health services passed in 2007 was aimed at increasing access to mental health services for low-income Minnesotans. Current law applies the higher reimbursement rate only to mental health clinics and centers that are designated as essential community providers. Nystrom does not meet the essential community provider designation due to being a for-profit entity. However, as demonstrated by the statistics I just referenced, we as an organization have a commitment to serving low-income and underserved populations. Due to this organizational commitment, we play a critical role in providing access to mental health services for low-income Minnesotans throughout Minnesota. We are bringing forward this legislation to broaden the 2007 mental health rate increase applicability to include those mental health clinics and centers that are not designated as essential community providers. We believe by equalizing the rates paid to different providers for the same mental health services, providers will be incentivized to continue serving and or to expand their provision of mental health services to low-income and underserved Minnesotans. I ask for your support of this bill today. Thank you.
Thank you. And is it Mr. or Dr. Nystrom?
Mr.
Mr. Nystrom, thank you for your testimony this morning. We do have a couple questions for you, Representative Murphy.
thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Heinzman, for bringing the legislation forward. I recall the work that we did in 2007 to do the rate increase, and I recall that we have given a little additional funding to essential community providers, not just in this version, but in different versions to make sure that underserved low-income Minnesotans have access to a provider, and we all know across the state of Minnesota the shortage of mental health care. So one of the features of essential community providers is that they have to serve all patients. They can't turn people away. Is that the case for your practice as well? Are you required to serve everyone, or can you turn people away? I understand you accept people in medical assistance, et cetera, but you have that same requirement in law?
Mr. Nystrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, our doors are open to all. We don't turn anybody away.
Yeah.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I understand that, and that's, you know, a charitable and Minnesota value that our doors are open, and I support that, but I think the requirement for the essential community providers is they must, and I think that must is critical when we think about making sure everyone has a place, a door to go through, and as I understand the difference between an essential community provider and others, that requirement doesn't apply to a practice like yours. Can you correct me if I'm wrong about that?
Mr. Nystrom.
Can you restate your question again, please?
Does the requirement to serve all,
Mr. Nystrom,
apply to your practice just like as it does to an essential community provider?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, technically no, but we do anyway because it's the right thing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that I do, and my questions are not meant as a value judgment, but instead a statement of the law, right? And for me, and I think for policymakers, we want to make sure there is a place for everyone. And we have rewarded with a rate increase the essential community providers because they have that extra burden. And I'm concerned that if we move forward with this piece of legislation and fund it, and I imagine it's going to be kind of expensive, but if we do that, then we take away that reward, if you will, financial differential for these clinics that have an additional burden that we've placed upon them as the state, and it might make it harder then for them to recruit and retain the staff that they need to care for this group of patients. So I just want to flag that for the chair and for the committee that by trying to do something to help this clinic, we may be unintended way undermining the power of the essential community provider and clinics across the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Murphy. Are there any other questions for Mr. Nystrom? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here today, Mr. Nystrom. I understand that your organization is a Christian-based organization, and I'm wondering if you could just give us I'm not exactly sure what that means in the context of mental health treatment. Could you just explain that a little bit? And the reason that I think is important is because what we're talking about here is the differential between these essential community providers, as Representative Murphy was talking about, and perhaps yours and other for-profit providers, and what the difference might be. So it would be helpful if you could explain that a little bit.
Mr. Nystrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, let me try to elaborate on that. From a licensing perspective, we do not instill any kind of Christian value on any of the, not to get bogged down in detail, but any of the community-based programs like CTSS and ARMS and things like that. In our outpatient program, if a client asks for Christian counseling or counseling that would from a therapist that reflects that value system, we would try to match that client with a clinician that could reflect those values. So that would be the essence, if you will, of what we would provide. And it's all over the map in terms of what people want. We work with Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus, atheists, everything. So we're religion blind in that perspective.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That was going to be my next question, so I appreciate that. And then it just sort of, from my own understanding, is so if somebody does ask for Christian-based counseling, is that reimbursed the same way? Is there any difference?
Sorry.
Mr. Astrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, absolutely, as long as there's a diagnostic assessment that was done, a mental illness was diagnosed, and there's a treatment plan, that can be legitimately treated.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, so I'm understanding you to say that that kind of counseling is reimbursed by the state the same way that other kinds of counseling would be?
Mr. Nystrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Mr. Nystrom? Yeah. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up kind of on what Representative Liebling was saying, I just, Mr. Nystrom, looked up your website here. It says Nystrom & Associates is a group of professional Christian clinicians from the fields of psychology. Each clinician's experience has a strong Christian value system and is committed to high standards of professional practice. Does that mean you wouldn't hire a non-Christian counselor?
Mr. Nystrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg? Yeah. No. We would hire non-Christians. Yeah.
Representative Freiberg. All right, any other questions for Mr. Representative Prisha?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering, Mr. Nystrom, I heard a couple of things here. I've heard that kind, and I've heard questions about, just tell me who you are and what you do.
Mr. Nystrom.
Can you be more specific?
I mean, tell me why you got into this and what you're trying to do as an outcome of your services.
Mr. Nystrom.
Sorry, I forgot your...
Representative Prisha.
Prisha, okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Prisha, I've been in this since 1979. This is a, I think like many people in the field, where it's a mission that we have. This is, I'm in this for my entire adult life. My passion is serving other people. We surround ourselves with other clinicians that have that perspective, and we employ a lot of people. This is what we do, but we see all walks of life, every kind of human problem that exists. We work with. We see every, I think we work with 20 different language groups on a given day around Minnesota. So we work with a vast population, and we don't discriminate against anyone. We work with everybody. I don't know if that answered your question or if you want more.
Representative Grisha.
Sounds like you're a good person doing good work. Thank you.
Thanks.
Any other questions for Mr. Nystrom? Seeing none, Mr. Nystrom, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify in House File 1258? All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please reintroduce yourself for the record and present your testimony.
It's good I'm reintroducing myself because now I'm representing MPA. I'm Steve Gerardo. I'm the current president of the Minnesota Psychological Association. And thank you for a chance to testify. In front of you, you have a handout that actually kind of talks about the details of the testimony, but I want to just say that I work in a community mental health center, and that's not a licensed community mental health center. It's a program much like Mr. Nystrom's. It's for-profit. And I'm in opposition of this this bill because limiting payment to larger organizations will limit access to services for this population. If you only pay higher rates for service to large organizations, community mental health centers, large groups of community providers, you're not going to be able to provide that to everybody. Minnesota Psychological Association has a lot of individual practitioners and small group practices that would not qualify under this, and they would be happy to provide the services for this population, but they have to pay their rent. And in my earlier testimony today, I mentioned that the workforce issues are related a lot to the financing. This is a profession that has not seen rate increases and has seen rate decreases over time while our costs go up. And that's why organizations like Nystrom and Associates and other organizations are seeking rate increases. But we can't limit it to just some winners and some people that aren't going to be meeting those requirements. And so it's really important to recognize the payment structure that does allow for essential community providers who are forced to take somebody no matter what. Within our organization, we do a lot of pro bono work. We write off a lot of services, but we are not required to start out from day one with somebody that doesn't have any insurance and doesn't have any way for us to be reimbursed. And I support that difference, and I understand that this does not meet that difference.
All right. Other questions for Dr. Giraldo? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Part of the thing that I think we struggle with, and this isn't the Finance Committee, but members of this committee, I think, at least maybe speaking for myself, we don't have any idea, really, what people get paid. And and part of the problem that we have, of course, is the PMAP system. So I know that the previous testifier talked about fee-for-service being a chunk of the payment, and I'm sure that's true for you as well. But we know that fee-for-service is a pretty small part of our Medicaid payment system, and that a lot of it is managed care. And then when we raise a rate, or say it passes this bill and it passes through and we raise the rates, we don't have any way of knowing if those managed care organizations are passing the money through. We just don't. We have no way of making them do it. So I'm just wondering if you can kind of give us a sense of, and I know that everybody isn't charging the same, but maybe you can just give us a sense of what the differential is. Can you do that?
Dr. Giraldo.
Wow. I'll do my best. Each insurance company pays different rates. They pay different rates under different contracts. The PMAPs have a different rate than the commercial contracts do. Historically, what has happened within the industry is that Medicare does a change, and then the insurance companies do a change. Medicaid does a change, and the insurance companies follow. The rates follow because they want their enrollees to get services in preference to people with lower level of insurance. And so they're going to offer a higher rate to make sure that their people get seen. And so there is a way that those two are related, but it's not a direct causal relationship that is guaranteed to happen every time. And so I think that's one of the most difficult things about the payment structure is that we provide the same service. I provide DBT services in our clinic, and we can have somebody who is being billed under intensive outpatient, who can be under day treatment, who can be under just group psychotherapy, and all those rates are different. That's why I was kind of saying wow at the beginning. I hope I answered your question.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's probably about as good as an answer as I could expect, but, I mean, that's just something that we really struggle with. So, as you know, I know we as a committee want people to get the care they need, and, we want them to be able to have quality health care at a cost they can afford. That's kind of our goal, I think, and yet the system we have is so complicated that it makes it really hard for us to get our arms around how to do that. So that's just a comment, and thank you for answering or trying to answer the question.
Sure. Any other questions for Dr. Giraldo? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1258? Seeing none, questions from members for the author? Seeing none, final word, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing my bill. It's a great bill. Appreciate your support.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1258 be referred to the Committee of Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1258 is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Heintzman. All right, next up we have House File 1404, Representative Baker. And as he makes his way forward, Representative Baker moves that House File 1404 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. And we have an A1 amendment for Representative Baker. Representative Baker moves the A1 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to enter that as well to make the bill the way I'd like to have it.
All right. Are there any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Baker, to your bill in the form you wish to present it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. And this is a very important good day today just because we're talking so much about mental health and the importance of what it does for so many of our residents. I'm going to keep it very, very brief just because we have a lot going on. But first episode, signals are really critical to members of our communities and our neighborhoods when they first are seen, and we've got to get on that right away to get our folks healthy as soon as possible. We did good work back in 2015, and this bill really kind of enhances what we did back in 2015. And I'll let our testifiers take over from at this point, but really good bill to help recognize some good programs going on here. So, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you please reintroduce yourself for this bill and bring us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abner, Holden County, Minnesota, and I do have a handout for you, some letters of support from some family members. As you know, schizophrenia is one of the most disabling conditions in the top 10, according to the World Health Organization, and it affects about 1% of the population. Psychosis is one of the main symptoms, which includes delusions, hallucinations, and losing touch with reality. We don't know all the reasons that psychosis develops. We can't really prevent it from happening, but we can prevent it from becoming disabling. And right now, frankly, we don't do much. It's like going to your doctor, finding out you have cancer, and being told to come back when you hit stage 4. We wait until someone has been hospitalized or committed multiple times before offering more intensive services and supports. People with schizophrenia often have multiple hospitalizations, are unemployed, have multiple contacts with the police, are more likely to be homeless, die 25 years earlier than their peers due to co-occurring health conditions, and have a high suicide rate. And then the study RAISE came along, funded by the National Institute of Mental Health, and it offered hope. Hope for recovery, hope for a better life, hope for better outcomes. And this is why NAMI Minnesota is so passionate about creating and expanding first episode programs. They try to identify early, provide intensive treatment and support, and most importantly, try to ensure that the trajectory of that young person's life goes in the right direction by helping them get back to school and work. The young person and their family learn that they are not alone and that they can still have goals and dreams. We need programs in each region of the state, and that's why we're back again to urge the legislature to fund what we know works and to offer hope and help to those impacted by psychosis. Now I'd like to turn it over to Nancy Howe.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Howe, and I'm the parent of a young adult who has struggled with severe mental illness for over 10 years. I'm testifying in support of House File 1404 regarding support for first episode psychosis programs. My 27-year-old son was diagnosed with schizophrenia as a junior in high school. Before he became ill, he played the violin, he played football, he was in drama, he was in debate, he loved to snowboard and was well-liked among his peers. Sadly, life for our family changed forever on September 23, 2006. Shortly thereafter, his friends had fled. Our family didn't receive support for my son's first episode of psychosis because the resources were so limited and fragmented at the time. It was an ongoing struggle to find providers and secure services. Since then, he has been hospitalized 10 times, has been in 2 90-day residential treatment programs, and is currently under civil commitment to take his medication. Even on medication, with the isolation that comes from having no friends, no work, and no purpose in his days, the voices often return in the silence. He recently described the anguish of living with dulled emotions, impaired memory, and the inability to think clearly as living in a prison in his own mind, largely because of the medication that he has to take to control the voices. He now receives basic county services, but it took years to get those in place. And sadly, with each hospitalization, his cognitive functioning has decreased and he has become more mentally disabled. Because of this disability, he hasn't attended college and is currently unable to work. A tragic situation considering that at one time he had an IQ of 124, a bright and creative mind. There's significant research that demonstrates that the earlier a first episode of psychosis is identified and treated, the better the long-term prognosis becomes. Having adequate funding in place for these programs is critical. Offering treatment and support for the family and the patient from the onset of the illness is essential to the individual's ability to develop into a contributing member of our community. So let's invest our resources in these first episode psychosis programs and avoid the devastating impact that numerous hospitalizations have on our loved ones, our families, and our communities. Thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Howe. Do you have any other testifiers, Representative Baker?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and address your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and esteemed members of the committee. My name is Laura Pianca, and I'm a third-year psychiatry resident and incoming chief resident at the University of Minnesota. As a resident and a physician, I have a personal passion for treating patients with first-episode psychosis. This occurs when someone experiences a loss of contact with reality, whether by hallucinations, delusions, or paranoia. These symptoms often prevent patients from attending school or holding a job and leave their families without adequate resources to offer help. Studies have shown that it's crucial for treatment to begin as soon as possible to promote recovery. The treatment is very complex and may involve medication management, cognitive remediation training, family and individual therapy, as well as social and occupational training. Unfortunately, there is currently a dire shortage of these programs here in Minnesota. Therefore, I'm in full support of HF 1404 to expand first episode psychosis treatment and to make great strides for psychiatric health care in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, questions from members? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the mother.
Yeah, just a question regarding your son. How old was he when he was identified as the psychosis, and then what is his age today?
Ms. Howe?
Yes, thank you, Representative. I'm sorry, I can't see
McDonald. Him. McDonald.
Thank you. He was diagnosed right before his 16th birthday. And I'm sorry, what's the second part of your question?
How old is he today?
He is 27 years old now. He has a very difficult life. He does receive support within the community, but because of the nature of his psychosis and the degree to which it tends to flare up, even on medication, it makes it difficult for him to work. It also affects his social skills, so he doesn't go out into the community and make friends. So,
very sorry for your story.
Thank you.
Your prayers are with you and your son.
Thank you so much.
Any other questions from members?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Leaving.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More to Ms. Abderholden, or I'm just wondering how this gets. First of all, I think this is a great idea, and I know that early identification, early treatment is really the way to go, and I'm just wondering how people find out about this, and how do I assume there's no problem identifying a first episode, you know, maybe that's more really restrictive than what's really intended. I mean, if they're having a second episode, is it too late to be part of this? I guess that's kind of the question.
Ms. Abraham?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, part of the grant program is actually for these projects to do outreach in their community, to go to the primary care, to go to the college campuses, to make sure that they know that this program exists. We've also found over the years that doctors and others are really afraid to say that this is psychosis because it bears such a heavy burden, in a sense, and it's a scary word. So we want to make sure that, you know, everyone in the community who might come in contact with the young person who's experiencing those kind of first symptoms are really moved into this program quickly. Right now, it's an average of 74 weeks before someone gets treatment, which is, frankly, not before they seek it. It could be another 3 months or more before they get in. So it's really important that we identify someone early on with their symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Mrs. Abner-Holman for bringing this bill forward and for Representative Baker carrying this bill. I'm on this bill because, you know, I personally experienced a young man in the summer who was suffering from acute psychosis and who was hearing the voices, who was paranoid, who was homeless. And a young man that I had known and saw him thrive in high school and went off to college. And 2 years later, he was homeless and really separated from his family, who could not understand that he was suffering from mental illness. You know, often enough, we see our young people who are in a state of disarray, and we say to them, you know, just, you know, get a job or go back to school or, you know, and really it's they can't, you know, they're paranoid, they can't make friends, the voices are overtaking their reality. And so, you know, my thought was when I saw him, you know, if he had gotten some help like 2 years ago, or even when I was trying to navigate the system with him to get the services that he needed, it was difficult. It was difficult because his reality wasn't reality anymore. And he did not even believe that. He didn't believe that he needed medication. You know, so early diagnosis, getting ahead of this and educating the community about what to look for, I think is really, really key to really helping these young people live productive lives where they can really re-enter the community in some type of really productive way. So, again, thank you for bringing this bill forward, and hopefully we can support it.
Mr. Chairman?
If I might, Ms.
Chairman, Representative, you know, I think one of the things, and if you looked at some of the letters that you received in your packet, you will see that people really did have better outcomes who were involved in this program, and that involving everyone, the family as well, to help them understand and how to support their loved one is really key. I did bring, in case anyone is interested later, we have a tape where you can listen to and hear voices so you can understand what it's like, and it's really, it is a very scary experience. So if anyone would like to see what it's like, I'd be happy to share the tape with people as well to really help understand how impactful this is.
Any other questions for members? Seeing none, Representative Baker, final word on your bill?
Mr. Chair, members, again, I think that our for far too long our mental health system has just relied on a fail-first methodology for mental health. And again, as Ms. Abraholden has said earlier, it's an average of 74 weeks before we get to the right help to someone experiencing this the very first time. Just imagine how good it can be if we got to them quicker. So with that, Mr. Chair, members, please support this bill, and we think this is a really important bill that we want to carry through the session.
With that, Representative Baker renews his motion to refer House File 1404 to HHS Finance as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Baker. Now we'll move to House File 1177. Representative Baker, why don't you introduce your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't believe I have an amendment on this one.
No.
So this one is clean, ready to go. This is a collaborative project that actually has been used in the past. Out in our area, we have a group of five counties that collaborate with mental health, and this particular bill I'm really proud to carry is it helps young adults transitioning into adulthood, so folks between the ages of 16 and 25. Again, one out of five youth has a mental health disorder. One out of four adults do as well. That is 25% of our population is struggling with this issue. But adolescence is the time when symptoms of major health concerns emerge, particularly ages of that 15 to 25. First episodes of psychosis, like we just talked about, major anxiety problems, and so on. Members, we have a bill in front of us today that really helped mentor and coach youth entering adulthood and finding work, finding employment, getting education, finding housing. So this project is proven to work. It has been successful in our area in the past. And Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to my testifiers. They've got some good testimony to share.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
My name is Becky Romoles. I am a parent as well as a retired psychiatric nurse. I want to tell you the story of my son. My son, Eric, was diagnosed very early on, at about age 3, with a myriad of mental health diagnoses. I think we went through 4 or 5 before finally, at age 15, he was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, which was indeed his true diagnosis. It was shortly after that, here he is 15, 16 years old, we're trying to get ready to see what's going to happen. He thinks he's infallible. He thinks he'll be able to go on and do things. And don't listen to your mother. That's not right. So what came along is a program called Pride 4, which was through our PACT 4 Mental Health Collaborative. It was a grant-based program where kids the ages of 14 on up to about 25, 26 were given these abilities. They received a coach. They received social skills training. They received ability to help with making applications with housing, with just some basic living skills. When a child is diagnosed with a mental illness, your whole focus changes, and you don't go along in a regular pattern. You select, and maybe you only make it 1 minute at a time. So as we go on, some of those things, I remember third grade when a teacher told me, you know, your son doesn't know the calendar. He doesn't know the months of the year. I said, where did we miss that? Those are all things that, some of those just minor things that we could do as parents. And then when they get to be 18, and some then decide, oh, you know, no, we're gonna be on our own. They aren't mature enough to handle that, and they end up with a failure. What this program does is provide positive reinforcement for these children, for these adolescents on the cusp of becoming adults. My son received a coach that helped him fill out an application for college. He was able to go through and get some tools for skill building, to run his own apartment, to have his own vehicle. He graduated from college. He went to get a job as a non-destructive testing technician, which to me, I had no idea what that was, but go for it. And he got a job in Michigan. He lived in Michigan for 2 years. Now, my son, unfortunately, although he built up a resilience and a spirit and really was a strong advocate and a strong person in the mental health system, he was a success story. But he couldn't battle the illness that he had, which was leukemia. And he died 4.5 years ago. And like I told Representative Baker, he's up there saying, Ma, get on this, because we need help for these kids. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Gomalez, for your testimony and sharing your story this morning. That was very helpful for us. There is a question. Representative Olson.
Actually, for the bill author.
All right. Thank you. All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rochelle Peterson. I am the Executive Director at PAC for Families Collaborative. We heard from Ms. Ramos about the experience with her son, and I'm so glad she was able to come to speak about this today. We are a Children and Families Mental Health Collaborative in rural Minnesota, as Representative Baker explained. I have worked 24 years in the settings with mental health and responding to mental health and sometimes crisis positions. I've seen firsthand the cost of society and the systems when mental health needs of young people go untreated. And I do have, I believe, a handout on page 2 of the Journey to Independence. If you would look at the section on yearly projected costs, I actually gather these costs by speaking directly to administrators of various entities on these program costs. In my job in 24 years, I have worked on the other end most often, sometimes on the preventative. So I see those costs every day, year after year, about what the burdens that they carry. Although one person rarely spends one continuous year, perhaps in residential treatment, it's entirely possible they could be a revolving door within residential and juvenile corrections, possibly equaling more than 1 year. I started my career working at a locked juvenile correctional facility, and I spoke to the director recently about the youth that they're seeing in their facility right now. He explained their desperation about meeting the needs in a locked correctional facility. That's a consequence-based program, but working with kids with mental health needs, saying that they're not equipped to deal with those issues, and they need more support and resources. They're overwhelmed, and the same conversation goes with local jailers, seeing 18-year-olds come through the correctional system because they get charged with an assault and land up in their jails. I've worked as a chemical dependency county case manager within a probation setting. I've worked as a CD counselor in a treatment center. Often there was so much more than just dependency, especially with the young kids who end up in the programs. Most recently, I worked for the State Public Defender's Office as a social worker. There, I probably saw the very end consequences of young people and what happens when mental health isn't addressed. My cases typically were of young people in their early 20s, and I would start digging into their mental health case history, and it was typically a very sad history. I'd work with their families and talk with their families, and they would say, I tried to advocate, I didn't know how, they didn't listen, if there were other resources, if there was someone to help walk us through. Most often, they had tried, but didn't know where to turn. I do believe, just in my own experiences working on a variety of systems work, that the earlier we can intervene and support families, that we can advocate, we can do preventative work, and I think it's echoed here today about the earlier work we do, the better the prognosis for society, for these families, and for the youth that we serve. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Peterson, for your testimony this morning. Are there any questions for these testifiers? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1177? Seeing none, I will move the questions to the bill author, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just had a couple of questions, Representative Baker. I love the idea of really focusing on rural and this demonstration project. Can you just say a little bit about the geography that served in this particular project?
Representative Baker.
Really good question, Representative Olson. I think my understanding is, again, it's a multi-county collaboration that has happened out in western Minnesota. I know that Wilmer and Candiway County is part of that. This was happening about 6 or 7, 8 years ago from this grant that was mentioned earlier. It's one of the programs that when it ended, they really fought hard. In fact, they kept it going for a couple more years under the county umbrellas, but they just couldn't support any longer. But it was one of those programs where it was a fabulous idea and we need to keep it going. It's been sort of dormant now for about at least 5, 6 or more years, and this is why it's so important. We want to keep bringing it up every year. But again, it's a great program for really all of Minnesota. This one happens to be kind of focused on rural settings and such. They just need more support because, as Becky Ramon said about her son Eric, he was well on his way. He was captured, got a great mentor and a coach, and got him kind of positioned in the right direction. And unfortunately, cancer took him. But he would have been a very productive citizen for us. So just think this is a great program and we should support it.
Representative Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the point in how the bill is written, it says that the commissioner would solicit for proposals and then award the grant to one. Are you aware of any other programs in the state that fit, that would be, you know, putting for proposals forward, or is it... Speak to that. Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this point, I know of only this one. It certainly encourages other collaborations. I know there's other mental health groups out there that might look at this, but I think it's something that this one might be teed up because it has had experience before. So this one is kind of specific written to rural Minnesota and hopefully some good collaboration.
Representative Olson.
Okay, and my last question. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Representative Baker, what do you see... hearing the testimony and the success of this and moving forward, how do you imagine, I mean, this has, we'll go through finance and there's a big price tag attached to this program. How would you imagine this being a demonstration around status and outcomes that, what's the future of this if it's successful to be replicated in throughout our state?
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, I would say, Representative Wilson, that again, our request here is $600,000 each year for the next 2 years. I would say that this is going to hire 8 to 10 mentors and coaches around the area. I think I had heard at one point they cover about 10 folks or 20 folks apiece. I'm not sure about that. But my hope is that if this works, it will keep expanding and it will find other sources of support, whether through federal or state financing. But right now we've got about, $1.2 million over the biennium to support this program. That's what I think our needs are. And again, it's basically just for the actual employees and the mentors and the coaches.
All right. Any follow-up, Representative Olson?
Thank you.
Any other questions for the bill author? Seeing none, final word, Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for supporting, I hope, this great mentoring kind of a bill for some folks going into adulthood. And as you all know, it's hard enough the way it is. So thank you.
All right. With that, Representative Baker renews his motion that House File 1177 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and House File 1177 is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Baker. Next, given the time, we're going to adjust the order just a little bit in the agenda, members, and we're going to go to House File 1282, Representative Keel. And as Representative Keel gets ready, she moves that House File 1282 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. We have the bill in front of us, Representative Keel. You have an A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Keel moves the A1 amendment. Representative Keel, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The amendment cleans up some of the language and I believe provides us with a better comfort level with House File 1282.
All right. Are there any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Keel, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1282 will provide greater access to qualified psychologists at a time when there is a shortage of high-quality mental health providers, with no change to the scope of practice. The bill addresses some challenges that have arisen around the specifications for licensure for academic psychologists and supervision requirements for the individuals pursuing their postdoctoral psychological employment. With that, members, I have a testifier that I believe will explain the purpose.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Dr. Robin McLeod. I'm a licensed psychologist in Minnesota. I'm speaking to you today in my role as the immediate past president of the Minnesota Psychological Association. I continue to sit on the executive committee of our professional association, and our current president and president-elect are also present here today. House File number 1282 is an update to the Minnesota Psychology Practice Act. It will provide greater access to qualified psychologists at a time when there is a severe shortage of highly qualified mental health providers in our state. And again, as stated by Representative Keel, it does this with no change to the scope of practice for psychologists. Early in 2016, prominent and highly respected psychologists in Minnesota began talking with the leadership of the Minnesota Psychological Association about surprising challenges they were facing regarding language in the Psychology Practice Act, specifying licensure for academic psychologists and indicating confusion over supervision requirements for individuals who were pursuing their postdoctoral psychological employment. In order to address these challenges and concerns, the leadership of the Minnesota Psychological Association began meeting with psychologist stakeholders from both academic and practice settings to develop revisions to statutory language that would solve the newfound ambiguities. So this bill, in addition to simply removing outdated language, does the following. It clarifies the requirements for licensure for individuals holding academic positions in our institutions of higher education for professors, those who teach psychology and conduct psychological research. It further specifies and clarifies postdoctoral supervision requirements. It changes the requirements for the volunteer license in order to increase the likelihood that psychologists will pursue this opportunity and make more professionals available for community and supervision activities in behavioral health care. It adds an inactive license status for individuals contemplating retirement or those who move to another state, something that is similarly provided in Minnesota licensing statutes for social work and by the Board of Medical Practice. This bill also eases the requirements for licensure by reciprocity, so that psychologists licensed in another U.S. jurisdiction can be more easily and quickly licensed when coming to Minnesota. It specifies training regarding statutory requirements for supervisors to ensure that they are meeting current requirements of statute and rule. And finally, it moves fees for various board activities to statute from rule, such that the fees will have greater oversight by the legislature. By voting to accept the revisions to the Minnesota Psychology Practice Act that are being proposed in House File 1282, you and your colleagues will be resolving concerns raised by prominent psychologists in both practice and academic settings. You and your colleagues will be clearing the way to bring more highly qualified psychologists into the mental health care workforce in Minnesota. And you will be increasing access to quality behavioral health care for the citizens of Minnesota. And you will be doing all of this with the consensus of psychologist stakeholders in practice, academic, and regulatory settings, with no additional financial burden on the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. McLeod, for your testimony this morning. Are there questions for Dr. McLeod? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1282? All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Angelina Barnes, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Psychology. First, I want to thank Representative Keel and the Minnesota Psychological Association, as well as the University of Minnesota, the private colleges, collaborative, as well as other individuals and stakeholders that put many hours into this bill, and we're striving to do the right thing in terms of making some of these corrections. Additionally, the A1 amendment resolves a majority of the board's concerns regarding the bill, and does make some substantial improvements for mobility of psychologists, including some of the barriers, regulatory barriers that were in place that did not add value for the citizens of Minnesota. The only remaining issue for the Minnesota Board of Psychology is that the changes do not come without cost. Oh my God. And so we are in the process of completing a fiscal note on this matter. And I know this isn't a finance committee, but I just want to clarify that in terms of a financial burden, we're not clear yet in terms of how much we can absorb, but definitely implementing multiple substantive and core changes to our licensure process, adding requirements for training, adding a new type in terms of inactive license, will have database impacts and will definitely require changes to that system. So thank you. I'll stand for questions.
All right. Thank you for your testimony this morning, Ms. Barnes. Are there questions for the testifier? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1282? Seeing none, questions for the bill author? Final word, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, please support the bill.
With that, Representative Keel renews her motion that House File 1282, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1282, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. With that, members, we do not have time to get started into another bill, so we are going to end things there for this morning. We will reconvene at 6 p.m. in Room 10 this evening. 6 p.m., Room 10. We'll see you there. We're in recess. Okay, the Health and Human Service Reform Committee will come back to order. We will be going a little bit out of sequence from the agenda tonight based on the bill authors who are in the room with us. And so we are going to jump down to number 15 on the agenda, House File 490, Representative Lean. And I will move that House File 490 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Lean, welcome to the committee. We have the bill in front of us. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate you hearing my bill tonight. And I will be brief and succinct. It sounds like you all have a pretty full agenda. But House File 490, the bill in front of us, provides a rate for nonprofit nursing homes located in Moorhead, equal to the median rate for nursing homes located in North Dakota cities contiguous to Moorhead. So largely this would be Fargo. The bill will finish work that Representative Backner and I started in 2015 when we were able to enact a similar provision for a nursing home in Breckenridge, Minnesota. Although seeing a more realistic state budget picture right now, North Dakota in recent years has raised its Medicaid rates paid to nursing homes. This was largely because of the oil boom, the oil economy in the western part of the state. This led to a wide rate disparity in rates paid in border communities and has resulted in serious staffing issues for nursing homes located in the Minnesota communities. The nursing home reform bill 2 years ago does help address the disparity, but it does not completely solve the problem in Moorhead. This bill is important to maintain the needed services for the elderly in the Moorhead area now and in the future. Mr. Chair, members, I urge your support of House File 490, and I have had Nathan Johnson provide some comments. He works at the nonprofit home in Moorhead, and unfortunately he was unable to make it tonight.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lean. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 490? Seeing none, are there any questions, final questions for the bill author? Seeing none, final word, Representative Lean?
Mr. Chair, members, I appreciate your time and attention on the bill. Thank you.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 490 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 490 is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Lean.
Thank you.
So, all right.
I should have one of them here. Gary or Aaron?
Yeah, Gary's in the doorway.
Should we get her? That's all I need.
Oh, we can get started. I think they'll know to walk in.
I think we're ready. Come on.
Okay, next on the agenda is House File 803. House File 803, Representative Baker. And as he's making his way to the testifying table, I will have Representative Baker move that House File 803 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Baker, we have the bill in front of us. When you are ready, please present your bill.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members. House File 803 is a bill that I feel is a very interesting kind of a senior care innovation, kind of a grant fund idea. We continue to hear about the acute shortage of professional caregivers from our senior care workforce, and we need to do a better job throughout the state to attract new members to this great industry. The goal of this bill is to attempt to increase the pipeline of available caregivers by supporting local innovations and partnerships aimed at addressing recruitment efforts. You'll hear a couple of the ideas, I think, tonight. But with me this evening, members, is a couple of testifiers that you are all very familiar with, so I'm just going to let them take it over from here, Mr. Chair.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your names for the record and present your testimony.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Erin Bowie. I am the Director of Government Affairs for Care Providers of Minnesota, here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I want to thank Representative Baker for bringing this bill forward. We've all heard the sobering facts on the aging population in Minnesota. We know 60,000 people are going to turn 65 every year now through 2030. We know that there will soon be more seniors than school-age children for the first time ever. And we also know that there are great workforce challenges ahead. So this bill tackles it from a new direction. We're hoping to get some new good ideas that might be local community-based, they might be regional, they might be statewide. We have talked with a number of folks who have had an interest. The International Institute is a great example. They have a great program here in the cities where they train new Americans in a CNA program. It has a 98% pass rate. And then the folks stay in the field afterward. We had talked to them about replicating this program in outstate Minnesota in areas with a high population of new Americans, and one of the big barriers to that is the budget. So this is something we would hope that they would apply for. We have another woman in western Minnesota who is working on an app. She is an adult basic education person, and she has created a program that that would teach adult basic education learners how to read in CNA language, and they would then be able to move into a CNA program and into a career learning in the language of a CNA. So again, I want to thank Representative Baker for bringing this bill forward. We're hoping that we get a lot of new, good, innovative ideas out of it.
Ms. Thurlow.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Senior Vice President of Advocacy at Leading Age Minnesota and also here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I know your agenda is long and the evening is going to go for a while tonight. So in the interest of brevity, I'll just say that this bill is really about encouraging innovation at the local level to help address our workforce needs. I think Ms. Bowie gave a lot of some of the examples of the possible. Our members are very creative and are looking for help to help foster the and support those ideas so that we can get more professional caregivers into the field. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions about the legislation.
All right, questions for these testifiers. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I'm interested and curious about this. And I'm wondering if you can help me understand the breadth of the grants. I know that's not a very articulate way to ask the question, but is there a boundary or a limitation to where the grants would go in terms of innovation? And sometimes people choose to work in a field because they're driven to work in that field, and sometimes they choose to work in a field because it's in a place that they already think of as home. And I'm wondering if you're tackling both of those ideas with this idea of innovation.
Ms. Thurlow.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the legislation is fairly broad in its criteria. The qualifying criteria are as to who can apply for the grants are listed in the bill, and they're really modeled after the home and community-based scholarship program that this legislature established a few years ago. And again, otherwise, it really is the eligibility is really for providers that specialize, that can apply for it, or providers that specialize or provide, the majority of their clients are older adults. But otherwise, and there is language in there about preferences of maybe targeted populations of underserved Minnesotans that may be needing assistance looking for work. So to connect to those populations that might be really really productive places for us to find professional caregivers. But other than that, the program is really designed to be flexible and to allow for a lot of creativity. So there aren't a lot of other barriers to entering into this program. And we would anticipate working with the Department of Health to establish that application process once the legislation is passed.
Representative Murphy, any other questions for these testifiers? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 803? Seeing none, any final questions for the bill author? No final words, Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it's a great innovative workforce bill that I'm really proud to carry. I hope we can start filling all the vacancies in our workforce issues up in this industry. So thank you very much.
With that, Representative Baker renews his motion that House File 803 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and House File 803 is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Baker. Next up, we will have Representative Dean with House File 945.
And Representative Dean is moving that House File 945 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Dean, we have the bill in front of us. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 945 is just a cleanup bill to address something that was not caught in the revisor bill that would just simply realign sections of the law to line up with each other. Need to move this forward. Appreciate your support.
All right. Do you have any testifiers, Representative Dean?
I have none.
Are there any questions for Representative Dean? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 945? Seeing none, any questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where is this bill going?
Finance.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Liebling.
We're moving so fast, I'm having trouble finding bills.
Sorry.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, could you explain why this bill is going to finance?
Representative Dean.
It just refers to a couple sections of law in Representative Schumacher's nursing home facility payment statutes from last year. It just needs to line those up, and that's where I want it to go.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dean, I apologize if I was a little distracted when you introduced this, but could you just explain a little bit more what exactly this is doing, because as I'm looking at the language of it, it's pretty, pretty hard to tell just from reading the actual bill.
Sure.
Representative Dean.
Well, as you know, Representative Liebling, it's a very complex bill, and the reference is made to 256B in a new chapter, 256R. It just there's some references that are to the old statute section that need to go to the new one, and that's all it does is correct it.
Right. And Representative Liebling, I have a bill coming forward, too, in a little bit, House File 1353, that's very similar to this, and we're going to send that to Finance as well for the same reasons, just to make sure that none of the cross-referencing have any fiscal implications with that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I'm understanding correctly, so it's more or less cleanup language, and then we're just going to make sure that it gets vetted to make sure it doesn't have fiscal implications? Is that kind of in?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you for indulging me on that one.
Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Dean? All right. Final word, Representative Dean.
Appreciate your support.
With that, Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 945 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 945 is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Chair Dean. All right, next we'll bring up Representative Poppy's two bills. Those two bills are House File 941 and House File 942. (clears throat) 941 and 942. Welcome to the committee, Representative Poppy. I will move that House File. Do you have a preference on which one you start with?
You can go in order, whichever.
Okay. I will move that House File 941 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Poppy, we have House File 941 in front of us. Two-year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 941 is a bill that would appropriate a small amount of money, $200,000 per year, that would go to the Minnesota Board on Aging, and there are seven area agencies on aging, so each of them would receive a share of that money, and they'd be able to use that money to help to provide some assistance for caregivers, especially caregivers for family members that have dementia or Alzheimer's. And the idea behind this is really just something that I have a personal interest in and believe that we need to be able to provide for caregivers to be able to keep people who are have a dementia-related illness, to be able to keep them in their homes longer and be able to provide the opportunity for the caregiver to get some respite as they would be able to. So the concept would be that the money would go to the Area Board on Aging, the Area Agency on Aging. Each of them would be able to then give out money to, especially maybe in rural areas, to smaller communities, to be able to have a community site that family members would be able to take their person to, and they would provide some training for volunteers to be able to work with the family members who have dementia, and also be able to just give some respite for the caregiver. So it would not come at a cost to the caregiver, but it would be an opportunity to give them some relief in a short amount of time. That's basically the bill.
All right. Do you have any testifiers this evening, Representative Poppy?
I don't have any that I have specifically with me. If there's anyone that would choose to come up, they certainly can.
Is there anyone who wishes to testify for or against House File 941? Seeing none, other questions for Representative Poppy on House File 941? Seeing none, final words, Representative Poppy. Poppy.
Thank you. I just appreciate your support.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 941 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. House File 941 is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance as the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Poppy, for that one.
Okay.
Next, we'll have House File 942. Again, with Representative Poppy, and I will move that House File 942 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Poppy, the bill is in front of us. Your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill actually increases the amount that would be in the monthly budget for the Essential Community Supports division of the allowing for people to have some money to help with their family members, and it would add companion services and respite care as being additional services that could be provided through the Essential Community Supports area. And again, this is something that I just think it's kind of front-loading the issue because we have, especially with dementia and Alzheimer's, it's just a high-cost, high-need area, and caregivers are in need of having some support, and sometimes they are not able to access a lot of services, but maybe if they could have some respite or if they would be able to have a companion service for their person in need of the service, that this would be helpful.
All right. Do you have any testifiers for House File 942?
I do not.
All right. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 942? Seeing none, are there any questions for the bill author, Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to say, Representative Poppy, that I am glad to see this legislation before the committee, and having had some experience caring for people with dementia, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, et cetera, that it can be really hard on a family. It can, you know, there's no beginning and end to that experience for family members, and I think it's important to recognize that and to support them in the many ways that we can, so I'm grateful to see this here tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Representative Poppy? Seeing none, final words, Representative Poppy.
Thank you again for the opportunity to be here tonight. I appreciate your support.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 942 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails on House File 942 as we refer to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you for coming tonight, Representative Poppy. All right.
Poppy.
Now we are going to switch to, did I say
Poppy?
Switch to House File 827, Representative Zerwas. House File 827. And as we are pulling that forward, I will move that House File 827 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Zerwas, we have the bill in front of us. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 827 is a cleanup from a 72-hour hold bill that we did last year. There was concern out of Ramsey County with the bill, and so that we did last year on whether or not it was in compliance with federal law to release names of individuals coming out of a drug and alcohol center that's funded through a federal federal dollars. And so, rather to be safe than sorry, lines 2.16 through 2.19 is comfort language, making everyone comfortable that the paragraph does not apply to the extent that notice would violate federal law governing the confidentiality of alcohol and drug abuse patient records under Code of Federal Regulation, Title 42, Part 2. And so the Ramsey County Attorney's Office contacted us with that tweak, and I think there is someone here from Ramsey County that can answer some questions, but that's the cleanup of the language from the 72-hour hold bill notice from last year.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 827? Seeing none, are there any questions for the bill author? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zerwas, I mean, this seems fine. I mean, I understand, I think, what you're trying to do, but the question I have is when you just put in a section that says, basically, if it violates federal law, we don't really mean that part. That's kind of the gist of what you're doing. I just wonder if that provides enough guidance to people who might actually be applying the law. It kind of assumes that people know what the federal rules are so that they won't cross that line. Is that a correct assumption? I mean, I don't know. You know, who would be applying this, or I'm just wondering, does that really do the job for people when they need notice of what they're allowed to do and not do?
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair and members, my understanding is that we're talking about a very unique circumstance as far as programs within Minnesota and facilities. We do have a testifier available from Ramsey County that I think can shed a little bit of light on that.
All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. My name is Claudia Brewington. I'm from Ramsey County. And this was brought to my attention via our county attorney's office. Our detox center is in part financed using federal funds. And the federal law protecting the confidentiality of alcohol and drug abuse patients is pretty restrictive. And the laws that was passed last year would be in conflict with the requirements of federal law. So we're asking for this exemption, and who would apply it was your question, and it would be the administrators of the program who would be reviewing this law and determining that it would violate federal rules, and giving the directive to the director of the program and staff that they could not release this information.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you for that explanation. I guess I'm still a little bit confused, because then it seems to me that what we're talking about, the paragraph that starts on 2.12, right, that's existing law, and then the bill is this disclaimer part of it, and it seems then to sort of contradict what we've got in existing law. Is that I guess I'm just wondering if this notification that we've put in law violates federal law, why don't we repeal it instead of just saying, well, it doesn't apply to the extent that it violates federal law? You know what I'm saying? Like, we don't really mean it. Here it is, but we don't really mean it because we know it violates federal law, so don't apply it. It would just seem to make more sense in that case to repeal it, unless I'm missing something.
Ms. Brewington.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, my understanding, and I'm not an attorney, is that the language stays in place so that other facilities that are not under the federal rule can still abide by this requirement. But for those facilities that do receive federal funding, insofar as that federal regulation prohibits them from following this rule, the state law, they would be exempt from that.
Okay.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. I think that makes it clear. Thank you. Appreciate that.
All right. Any other questions for the author or for Ms. Brewington? Seeing none, Representative Zerwas, final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
With that, I renew my motion that House File 827 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 827 is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Zerwas.
Thanks, guys. Have a good night.
You too.
Stick around. We'll be here next.
The next bill we'll have come forward is House File 804, Representative Keel. House File 804.
All right, Keel.
And as Representative Keel is making her way forward, I will move that House File 804. Representative Keel will move that House File 804 is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Keel, we have the bill in front of us. When you are ready, please present your bill.
Okay. I have a couple of test cards. I'm just making sure they knew what was going on, too. Good evening, everyone. Members, I'm pleased to present House File 804, which is a bill that attempts to address the caregiving workforce shortage by improving several training opportunities for individuals who work in senior care settings. The bill includes expansion to nurse loan forgiveness program, enhancements to nursing facilities, and a home and community-based scholarship programs, and removes some of the barriers to TMA training in nursing facilities. With that, I have Erin Bowie and Carrie Thurlow here with the long-term care imperative, and I'll let them take it away.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name once again for the record and present your testimony.
Good evening again, members. My name is Erin Bowie. I'm Director of Government Affairs for Care Providers of Minnesota here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I want to thank Representative Keel for bringing this bill forward. As we talked about earlier, we are facing a real workforce shortage in long-term care, and this bill is hopefully another piece of the puzzle. We are looking at expanding the nurse loan forgiveness program to include home care nurses and nurses working in housing with services settings. And then the TMA portion, we actually won't be addressing tonight. We were unable to work out a few details, so we will possibly be revisiting that sometime in the future.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow, here on behalf of Leading Age and the Long-Term Care Imperative. In the interest of time, I'm happy to answer questions. Just a couple of other things that that are in the bill just to draw your attention to. One is that it expands the nursing facility scholarship program to address student loan debt for individuals that would otherwise qualify by removing the requirement that those folks that have student loans be newly hired and recently graduated. Ms. Bowie already covered the nurse loan forgiveness program. So then the last part is the nursing, the home and community-based services scholarship program. This was a program that was established in 2015 and has been hugely successful, so much so that in the first two rounds, demand has greatly exceeded the appropriation. And so this portion of the bill actually expands the appropriation to accommodate more demand to help folks providers in those areas help recruit and retain staff. So with that, we're happy to answer any questions about the legislation.
Are there any questions for Ms. Thurlow or Ms. Bowie? Seeing none, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 804? Seeing none, final questions for the bill author? Seeing none, final word, Representative Keel.
Please support the bill.
With that, Representative Keel renews her motion that House File 804 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 804 is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Keel. Okay. All right, so we're going to take a moment here to move the gavel around, and then I'm going to present the four bills I have up this evening.
Thank you.
Chair Schumacher is getting ready. We'll move House File 500 to be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 500 is a cleanup for the value-based reimbursement bill that was passed 2 years ago. As with all major changes, you start to see that there are things that definitionally made sense at one point but didn't once it was starting to get worked through. And so a lot of what this bill does is just provide for clarification on those things now that we've been underway with that process for a couple of years. To save time tonight, I will just ask my testifiers to walk through the bill briefly with you and take any questions that you may have.
To the testifiers, introduce yourself and present your testimony to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schumacher. My name is Todd Bergstrom, and I work with Care Providers Minnesota. I'm here with Jeff Bostick from Leading Age Minnesota, and we're here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. So as Representative Schumacher indicated, this is, generally speaking, a cleanup and policy clarification bill. The idea is to address some of the ambiguities from the large bill that was passed 2 years ago and strengthen a couple of areas as well. Specifically, just to go over a few of the items that we wish to clarify. So first, we'd like to clarify that nurse consultant costs are part of direct care. They are being treated as such, but we'd like to clarify that in statute. We would also like to come up with a slightly different way of allowing larger entities to allocate those nurse consultant costs amongst facilities. We would also like to clarify the definition for healthcare costs. So under the present language, it refers to the ACA. And so our bill would take the definition of full-time employees from the ACA and just place that directly into Minnesota statute. There's additional detail about what fringe benefits are allowable costs for rate calculation. We do not believe that that's actually changing interpretation, but simply codifying what those fringe benefits are. We would also sunset the minimum wage rate increases that were passed in 2014, the idea being that those rates, as you move forward, are being built into the new operating rate that was established under payment reform. And so if we do not remove them, it will begin to cost the state more money than was originally fiscal noted. Similarly, we would like to, this is language that I believe DHS has proposed as well, reduce the penalty amount or the amount that DHS has, the threshold that DHS needs to meet to reduce penalties regarding kind of inadvertent submission of MDS assessments to the Department of Health. And then finally, we'd also like to coordinate non-property project rate increases to either a January 1 or July 1 rate year. Right now, providers may request those at any time. The Department of Human Services and us agree that it would be easier for them to administer the new system if rate increases were not being requested all the time under certain items such as bed layaway, single bed incentive, or bed closure. And then finally, I'll note that we'd also like to allow providers to once a year change what is called their single bed election. Presently, you can do that whenever you lay away a bed or close a bed or do a construction project. We would like to return to the process where you could request such a change once a year. And with that said, I'd like to turn it over to Jeff Bostick.
Hello, Mr. Chair. Jeff Bostick of Leading Age Minnesota on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Just to run through quickly a couple more of the more significant provisions in here. There's some language from what's called the APS, the old alternative payment system, that talked about an inflation adjustment, which over the last several years has been restricted to just the property portion of the rate, which is a small portion of the rate that we're looking at redoing at some point in the future. In the meantime, we would clarify that language so that that small inflation adjustment applies to that portion of the rate again starting in 2018. We would clarify that electronic signatures are allowed. There are some areas within the law, references to time cards, for example, that say signatures are required. So we're just kind of updating to modern practices in that case. We're looking at requiring, this is some language that DHS has offered up in their bill, that we're going to include the DHS report on the impact of the system on a regular basis, every 2 years it calls for. And then we have language that would suspend the critical access nursing facility program for an additional 2 years. It was suspended 2 years ago when we passed the VBR system because it essentially became obsolete because it gave certain facilities a cost-based rate, which now everyone gets a cost-based rate under VBR. And we haven't come up with essentially a use for that program going forward yet, but in talks with the department, we're interested in suspending it and maybe coming back in a couple of years and seeing if there is some reason why certain facilities in rural, deep rural areas would benefit from having a status like that. But for now, that we don't have a proposal to do that, so that's why we're calling for the suspension. And I think with that, we would take any questions anyone has.
Chair Schumacher, do you have any other testifiers?
No.
Okay. Would anybody in the audience like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, members, questions?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Liebing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, I was interested in that last thing that you were talking about with the alternative rate. And if I'm understanding what that is, this is something that would happen. It's in law, and it would be happening, except that the bill is suspending it but keeping it in law for another couple of years. Did I understand you correctly?
On the alternative payment system adjustment?
Yes.
I would have to go look at what the current law says. It, I believe, was kind of ambiguous in terms of what would happen with that. It was one of the things that was kind of left open. Historically, it has been applied to the property rate over the last several years, and this would kind of reinstate that and clarify that it applies to the property rate starting October 1 of 18. It was suspended through, I think, the end of the existing biennium, and then the existing language would kind of say that it applies to the entire rate because that's how it was originally conceived back in the 90s, but it hasn't been applied that way in a long time, and I don't think DHS was intending to apply it that way, so it's just kind of it's just mostly a cleanup piece.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you point me to where that language is in the bill?
Section 4.
Mr. Bostic.
Yeah. I believe it's in Section 4.
Yep. Okay, I think I found that.
She's found that.
It's on. Starts on line 4.14.
Okay.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Yeah, I just one further clarification. So it's my understanding that these are. So it is traditionally and still only applies to the property rate. It would have been effective, I believe, in October 1 of either 2018 or 2017. What we're doing is proposing to move it to January 1 and then clean up a lot of spurious language that I believe is concurrent with what the governor's language says.
Representative Liebman.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. It's kind of confusing to read this, you know, not that. Yeah, rates for nursing homes aren't exactly simple. We know that, right? But I thought I understood you to say that this was something that would go into effect. This alternate rate would still be in effect, but that we were suspending it in this bill because we're just kind of keeping a language in the law in case we need it later. And that was what kind of piqued my interest.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Yes, so, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, this is where it's become a little confusing. So there's a property rate section that is coming back online that we're changing the dates on. That's the section we just referred to. There's also a critical access nursing home program that is was suspended for the previous or the current biennium, and this would propose to suspend it another 2 years while evaluation of the present system is undertaken and also perhaps better ideas as to how to identify what critical access nursing home residents may be identified.
And that's section 23, and if you starting on page line 12.21, and you'll see at the very end of that section, it just changes a suspension date from December 31 of 17 to December 31 of 19.
Okay, so Representative Lieberman? Yeah, thank you. That is what I was trying to get to. So my question about that then, as I understood how you explained it, with the new rate system, we shouldn't really need that because we're now doing a cost-based system. So there shouldn't be any need to get any special additional rate, which is what a critical access rate would be, right, where we'd be giving a special additional rate to one facility or a group of facilities because of the low reimbursements they're getting or something like that. So what I understood you to say then is that we're just kind of extending this date and kind of keeping it alive just in case we need it later. And I guess what I would the question then that I have is, so if nobody remembers about this, and we just put this new date in December 31st, 2019, and then nobody remembers to come back and adjust it again or get rid of it or put the date out further, what happens at that point? Does somebody begin to get a higher rate or an additional payment without just because we haven't paid attention to it? That's the concern that I have.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, no, the way the language is structured is that it's an RFP process. And I think one of the underlying assumptions is by suspending this, there has been discussion in the last couple of years about other areas of critical access as it relates to mental health or behavioral or even really rural areas where even a new payment system homes may be struggling. And I think the idea is by suspending it, there might be time to, again, rethink if there's a way to support this program.
But, yeah, just to be completely clear, there's no money that would be automatically dispersed starting January 1 of 2019, January 1 of 2020, just as a result of this language still being here.
Okay. Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Representative Lieberman.
Thank you. That helps because, you know, we did put a lot of new money into the nursing home industry. And I'm actually kind of anxious to see what those numbers turn out to be because now we've gone to this cost-based system, and I just want to make sure that we're not putting anything additional in there without knowing about it because this is going to cost the state a lot of money. You know, we all understood that nursing homes were in a really difficult spot. As we know, home and community-based services are in a really difficult spot. Everybody's in a really difficult spot, it seems. But I just wanted to be sure that we weren't putting something more on automatic pilot without realizing it. So thank you.
Members, any other additional questions? Seeing none, Chair Schumacher, any final comments?
Nope.
Okay, with that, Chair Schumacher moves his motion to re-refer House File 500 to the HHS Finance Committee. Thank you.
We should probably vote on that.
Oh, yeah. Here. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Motion passes. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that House File 823 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Reform. House File 823.
Chair Schumacher moves to House File 823 to be re-referred to HS Finance.
Is it reform?
Yeah, finance. HHS Finance.
We've already heard this bill once in our committee. We don't need to again.
We have to disagree once in a while. Anyway, Chair Schumacher, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. In our continued effort, we just talked about what the value-based reimbursement system did. As we're looking at the aging of Minnesotans and where that goes, we worked on the facility rates this last time, and now we're coming back to look at the reform to the elderly waiver program that we have in front of us here. And we want to make sure that we have a system that's better suited for our seniors. The things we want to do are highlight quality. We want to be able to have quality as part of the rate setting for what we do moving forward. And we also want to have more participation in the feedback that the recipients of elderly waiver get. Just one note on this, there are several different waiver reform bills that are moving forward this year. Recently, we heard one on the disability waiver rate system that I'm also carrying. I just want to clarify that proposals like this one, the 4% campaign, and that DWRS bill aren't conflicting proposals or anything like that. All of these are dealing with different sets of waivered services. For the elderly waiver services in particular, we want to try and calibrate the system going forward. We want to try to deal with the workforce issues that we have and do more performance measures for the groups so that we can make sure that we have a quality system moving forward as well. And with that, I will turn it over for more technical speak from the testifiers.
Do the testifier go ahead and present your testifying and introduce yourself to the committee.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schumacher. My name again is Todd Bergstrom. I work with Care Providers in Minnesota here with Jeff Bostic from Leading Age, representing the long-term care imperative. What Jeff and I would like to do is give a general overview of the bill that's in front of you. So just to kind of start with, so beginning over a year ago, we began meeting with our members to reform the elderly waiver program. As you probably know, the elderly waiver program began over 25 years ago and is presently used by over 30,000 Minnesotans annually to cover the cost of care that helps them stay in the community and reduce state spending on more expensive long-term care settings. It is really important to note that to be on the elderly waiver, besides meeting the Medicaid financial tests, a person must meet the same level of care required to reside in a nursing facility. With the goal of preparing EW to serve a growing number of seniors in the future, our proposal reforms payment, policies, and improved processes, and as noted, while investing in quality and performance measurement. There are three areas of general kind of redesign within our reform bill. The first is payment and payment-related policies for elderly waiver. The second is quality and performance measurement. And then the final is kind of collaboration and accountability as it relates to some of the how some of the administrative functions work within the system. I'm going to speak about the payment processes that we're that we've addressed under the elderly waiver reform bill. So first, it's very important to note that elderly waiver provides services in assisted living settings or housing with services, however you want to call it, as well as in the community. And our proposal addresses both the rates on how they're constructed and both those types of services. The main proposal or the central part of how we're proposing to reform the rates is to annually create new service rates every January based on the personnel employed by using annual wage market information from the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. And after we've done that, we would then apply factors including taxes and benefits, program support, administration, and RN and social worker oversight. What does that mean? Well, so for example, under the elderly waiver / CADI residential services payment rates, we would create new rates for home management support services, home care aid, home health aid, and medication setups by a licensed nurse. For in the community, so EW, elderly waiver, alternative care, and a couple other affiliated programs, after speaking with the Leadership Council on Aging, and having some discussions with DHS, we identified the following rates to be basically reformed and recalculated annually. They are chore services, companion services, home-delivered meals, homemaker with personal cares, homemaker with cleaning, and homemaker / home management, as well as some additional changes to how adult day services and respite care services are provided. Within payment for services in housing, so I'm going to transition a little bit to a couple of different payment policies. In housing, residential, assisted living or assisted living, we propose a couple other reforms. The first is presently when someone moves into an assisted living or housing with services setting, often if they're coming from the community, the first month or two can be pretty chaotic and difficult to determine what exactly the person's needs will be once they're stabilized. So we're proposing that those first 2 months, the state under the Elderly Waiver Program and assisted living setting would pay the average plus 20%, and then on day 63, the case manager would come in and establish a brand new person-centered specific payment. We also propose additional license or to allow licensed nursing services for residential clients. We would create and allow specific licensed nursing services to be authorized and funded within EW, such as injections, wound care infections, diabetic care, et cetera, even if the provider is not Medicare certified. We would also create a process to allow for emergency or in lieu day payments where situations such as hospitalization or nursing home placement could be avoided. And then finally, there's also a disability, or not disability, I should say, cognitive and behavioral needs factor that we are proposing to put in the payment for assisted living services. I'm going to now turn it over to Jeff Bostick.
Mr. Bostick, welcome to the committee again, and please present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to talk. I'm Jeff Bostick with the Leading Age Minnesota on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I'm going to talk about a couple of topics briefly. We have some funding proposed in our bill to institute some performance measurement that is not in place today, specifically for residential providers of services under EW. We proposed four measures. Our goal would be to work with the department on figuring out how to put measures in place in these areas, which are formal customer satisfaction surveys, using the survey results that exist from the Department of Health surveys, and then collecting some data, some workforce data, on, in particular, probably retention and staff training and education, and developing, like I said, measures in each of those areas, testing those measures, sharing them with providers, and ultimately with the goal that they'd be used as payment incentives at some point in the future, although I should be clear that the proposal that we have today to redo the rates does not include any of that yet, because we feel like the measurement piece has to be in place before we figure out how to do that. Finally, there are a few improvements to the process that we've talked about with our members and that we've included in the bill and that we're looking to advance along with the changes to the rates. One is there's currently under the Elderly Waiver Program no standardized rule for when you do a reassessment and reset the person's service needs. That's become a much more common need of situation with the complexity of people receiving services in Elderly Waiver, particularly people who are in customized living settings are much more complex than they used to be. Their needs change more often, and the idea that you would just be reassessed after a one-year period of time, you could have some substantial needs that are not being funded in the meantime. And we are also working with the department on a way to, there's a lot of issues around financial eligibility and getting that approved and also having service eligibility in place so that you can get those things synced up and get the payment from the point where the person is actually both financially eligible and in need of services. And under current law, the service assessment lasts for 60 days and will expire at that time, and we're looking at doing something to extend that time period, probably with phone assessments that kind of renew the service assessment if the financial assessment is taking a long time to the financial eligibility is taking a long time to get put in place. And with that, I believe we're open for any questions.
Well, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Bostick. Chair Schumacher, do you have any additional testifiers? Are there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. Members, any questions? Seeing none, Chair Schumacher. Any final comments?
Pass the bill.
Okay. With that, Chair Schumacher re- uses motion to re-refer House File 823 to HHS Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion passes. With that, Chair Schumacher, do you have a preference which bill you deal with next?
Mr. Chair, I think we can take House File 582. I'd like to move that House File 582 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance.
Okay, with that, Chair Schumacher, do you want to present your bill?
Yes. House File 582 is just a quick change. There has been some issues with the Supplemental Nursing Services Agencies, the nursing agencies, the pool agencies there, and the definition of a nurse. We want to make sure that the definition of a nurse is clear, and we also want to ensure that the costs for the pool, that housing and travel is appropriately considered with that. And that's the bill.
Chair Schumacher, do you have any other testifiers?
I have Mary Krinke here for any technical questions.
Anybody in the audience would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, members, any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. I'm looking at the bill, and I don't see where the payment piece that you were talking about a moment ago.
Representative Liebling, that'd be in the committee engrossment version.
Ah.
So I was referring to lines 2.2 on.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Schumacher, or maybe Ms. Krinke. So, the 2.16, a nursing home that pays for the actual travel and housing costs for supplemental nursing services agency staff working at the facility, and it pays these costs to the employee, the agency, or another vendor, is not violating the limitation on charges described in the section. So, Representative Schumacher, would those extra costs be, I know you understand this new payment methodology much better than I do, but would those new costs be baked into the rate setting then, even though they don't violate the limitation on charges? Under your bill, do they get baked into the rate setting methodology so that when we're talking about average costs, that those things increase the costs overall?
Mr. Bostic, would you like to respond to that question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, Representative Schumacher. So two things. So you're right to identify that that does become an allowable cost outside of what the cap pool rates are, i.e. actual travel and housing costs. But if you read down at the bottom, beginning on line 2.34, you can see under the subdivision administrative costs under the nursing home payment, those are added in as allowable costs. But and this is where, to answer your question, administrative costs are part of the other operating price. A facility's actual administrative costs are not addressed or are not met kind of dollar for dollar. So unless the median facility in the 7-county Twin Cities metro area is reporting these costs, the other operating price will not go up. So it's an allowable cost, but it's not something that a facility will receive kind of directly reimbursed to them, if that makes sense.
Mr.
Representative Liebling.
So thank you. So then, Mr. Bergstrom, are you saying that this will not increase the costs overall at all?
Mr. Bostic.
In the rate setting.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I would defer to the Department of Human Services as they conduct the fiscal notice. But the questions you're asking about, it's my understanding, at least how I would view it, is that they would not, specifically adding in these as allowable costs, would not increase the cost of the payment system. It's merely allowing the activity. But again, this part of the payment rate is a price. So
if the department's here, they could come forward and speak to this. I think they probably went home for the night. Oh, no, here they are. Please come forward and present your testimony and introduce yourself.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kim Brenny, and I work for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And Mr. Bergstrom is correct in that this is in the other operating price. We have not yet done the fiscal note on this. I'm not sure if one has been requested or not. I know that we've got a couple of them in the hopper that we expect to have ready early next week. So I can't speak specifically as to whether or not this would, but it is something that we will be doing a fiscal note on if we haven't been asked to already.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you for that testimony. Any additional questions from members? Seeing none, Chair Schumacher, any final comments? Okay, with that, Chair Schumacher renews his motion to re-refer House File 582 to the Committee on HHS Finance. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion passes. Now I think we go to the final bill for Chair Schumacher.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that House File 1353 be re-referred to Committee on Health and Human Service Finance.
Okay. With that, present your bill, Chair Schumacher.
Thank you. This is the one, members, that we talked about a little bit ago, very similar to House File 945 with Chair Dean and his bill. It's correcting obsolete language and some cross-references, and I believe I have a couple of amendments to present. The A4 amendment is the only amendment that I wish to present. Mr. Chair.
Okay, Chair Schumacher presents the A4 amendment. Members, any questions to the A4 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion passes. Okay. Do you want to speak to A3
amendment? No, I won't be offering that one. Members, this bill is technical corrections and the cross-references. Cleaning up some of that. It has a few different, a few more than what Representative Dean did and in his bill, and so I'm asking you to move it forward.
Chair Schumacher, do you have any testifiers?
Not a one.
Anybody in the audience would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, members, any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lieberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Schumacher, is this the kind of bill that probably came forward from staff saying we need to do some cleanup? Is that kind of the genesis of this, just so we can kind of all understand what we're dealing with here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, yes, that's where it came from. It actually, from my understanding, when the elderly waiver bill was being drafted, the reform bill there, that a lot of these were discovered, and that's where it came from our very own staff.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Liebling?
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, any final words?
Not a
Chair
word.
Schumacher? Okay, with that, Chair Schumacher renews his motion to re-refer House File 1353 to HHS Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher.
Good evening, Mr. Chair.
Good evening, Representative Albright. Welcome to the Health and Human Services Reform Committee.
Happy to be here.
Representative Albright moves that House File 1194 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Albright, when you are ready, to your bill.
Mr.
Chair, members, House File 1194 deals with support for children receiving residential mental health treatment. Since 2001, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services allowed Minnesota to receive federal Medicaid matching funds from residential mental health treatment for children on medical assistance. CMS is now requiring Minnesota to designate each of these treatment programs with over 16 beds as IMDs. If those among the committee members are unfamiliar with that vernacular, it stands for Institutions for Mental Disease. Programs that are determined to be IMDs will no longer be eligible for federal Medicaid funding. CMS has given the Department of Human Services until January of next year to complete its review of all children's residential mental health treatment programs in the state, which of 700 children, which consists of 700 treatment beds. Those are in jeopardy of losing federal funding as a result of this change. Minnesota has a program in place that pays for MA-covered services for individuals when they are in an IMD using state-only fund. However, children's residential treatment services are not eligible to utilize this funding stream under current state law. Without a change to allow medical assistance to make up for the loss of federal funding for residential mental health treatment, counties would bear 100% of the cost for children on fee-for-service MA, and there would be no mechanism to pay for services for children who receive MA through managed care. This bill, House File 1194, appropriates state funding to cover the loss of federal funding and provides a small appropriation to conduct an analysis of the continuum of care for children in Minnesota to ensure we have the right services and the right funding mechanisms in the right places to keep children in their communities and families when possible. With that, Mr. Chair, I do have testifiers to the bill, and they are happy to testify to the technical aspects therein.
All right. Are there any questions for Representative Albright? Seeing none, Representative Albright, did your testifiers wish to give more than just technical?
They are available for questions for the members, but seeing none.
All right, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1194? Seeing none, any other questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Albright, I was kind of hoping you were going to have your testifiers because I just wanted to hear a little bit more about this. I'm familiar, of course, with this problem, but, you know, we've done so much talking and work on our whole mental health system, and I'm just wondering how this all fits in, because we did have the mental health task force. I don't know to what degree that task force worked on children's mental health in particular, but you know, you've got this report and recommendations. I'm just kind of wondering how all that fits together. Could you speak to that, or could somebody else come up maybe and speak to that?
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that at this juncture it would be more appropriate for the testifiers to come forward and give their testimony.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, I'm Jamie Halpern with Hennepin County Human Services Department, and I'm testifying today on behalf of Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, MACSA. MACSA strongly supports this legislation. Thanks to the author for introducing it. This bill provides critical bridge and funding to sustain the fragile mental health system, the system of services for children with serious mental health needs. The bill helps Minnesota create a longer-term plan for the development of a stronger continuum of intensive mental health services, and it establishes recommendations for a sustainable and community-driven system of care for children and youth with serious mental health needs. Residential treatment programs are a critical component of Minnesota's mental health system for children and youth whose mental health conditions and related behaviors need intensive 24-hour care and treatment. It is a necessary service used by all of Minnesota's counties. Intensive community-based care is also a necessary component of our mental health system and is something that is sorely lacking throughout our state. This bill will ensure that the funding for residential treatment remains intact until replacement funding plan can be put together. It also creates a plan for the development of intensive community-based care to help youth who have been served in residential treatment programs, and also helps us develop effective treatment alternatives that should serve children in their homes and communities where possible. As mentioned, without this legislation, the classification of Minnesota's residential treatment programs as IMDs will result in a new unfunded fiscal obligation for Minnesota's counties and property taxpayers, as the loss of federal Medicaid reimbursement will need to be replaced with local tax dollars. As most of you know, the child protection reforms in 2015 have been costly, and although the legislature provided significant funding to enact these reforms, it's estimated that the annual cost of these reforms to counties in excess of the new state funding will total approximately $20 to $30 million a year. These costs, together with the pending loss of Medicaid reimbursement for Minnesota's residential treatment programs, could likely result in the elimination of essential programs and services for our children and youth. So on behalf of Minnesota counties, I urge you to support the proposal. I'd be happy to answer questions.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Halpern and Representative Liebling?
Thank you. Thank you for that. That's really helpful. Is this something that was not really considered in the governor's? The governor had the task force on mental health, and I realize that didn't go into great detail. It was more of an overview and talked about different pieces we needed in place. But can you refresh my memory? Did they just not really deal with the children's mental health system?
Mr. Halpern.
Chairman Schumacher, Representative Liebling, I'm afraid I'm not the one that able to answer that question. I wasn't a participant in the task force. Is there someone? Sue Abderholden can probably address that.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and help us with our questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Keith Kozerski, Senior Director of Children and Family Services for Catholic Charities. I've spoken with a member of the staff from the Department of Human Services, and this was considered by the committee, and there was a recommendation by the committee to look at a bridge while there is a more substantive look at this issue, so that we don't have the over 700 children end up in places like emergency rooms or their parents calling law enforcement because they're unable to handle their behaviors in the home.
Mm-hmm. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's fine. I was more even thinking about the study that's in the bill. And I'm just, am I safe in assuming that this is something that's not duplicative, but it's just, it looks like it's kind of taking a deeper dive maybe than the task force would have been able to do and going into more specifics. Am I understanding that right? I just wanted to see how that all fits together.
That is correct. It's a deeper dive at a very specific part of the children's mental health system.
Representative, please.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions for the bill author or for any of the testifiers? Seeing none, final word, Representative Albright. With that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 1194 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1194 is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Albright. Next up, we'll have House File 1195. Representative Albright moves that House File 1195 be referred to the General Register.
And Mr. Chair, I do have an author's amendment to this bill.
Here, yes, that is.
The H1195A1-1.
All right, Representative Albright moves the A1-1 amendment. Representative Albright, to your amendment.
What this is doing is clarifying some of the verbiage in the later pages. It also just tightens up the language, particularly with regard to definitions.
All right. Are there any questions for the A1-1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1-1 amendment is adopted. Representative Albright, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Mr. Chair. And
I'll allow it.
Members, in 2015, the legislature approved the Children's Psychiatric Residential Treatment Facility Services as a new MA benefit to be fully implemented by July 1st of 2018. PRTFs are intended to serve children who require a more intensive level of care due to serious and complex mental health needs and other highly aggressive or self-harming behaviors, mental health diagnosis, neurodevelopmental disorders, psychosis, and or other health conditions. The first PRTF beds are expected to be available in July 2017 and will enroll providers to create capacity for 150 beds statewide at up to six sites. This bill establishes a rate-setting process for PRTFs in compliance with federal requirements. Specifically, this bill in Section 1 clarifies that DHS can use available grant funding to help new PRTF programs with startup costs. The 2015 legislature appropriated money for this purpose, and no new money is being requested. Sections 2 through 4 outline how payment rates are set for the new service and establishes an admission and discharge criteria, which is something the legislature directed DHS to develop as part of the 2015 legislation. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'm happy to answer any questions. I would specifically believe that our testifiers that spoke to 1194 probably would be able to speak to 1195 as well.
All right. Is there anyone who wishes to testify on House File 1195? Seeing none, are there questions on House File 1195 for the bill author? Seeing none, final word, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 1195, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 1195, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Albright.
Thank you,
ma'am. Finally tonight, members, we have House File 1139, Representative Keel. Representative Keel makes her way up. She moves that House File 1139 be referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Representative Keel, we have the bill in front of us. Whenever you're ready, please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We've heard a lot of a variety of mental health bills today, and I know we're all interested in helping people to seek the treatment they need and become stable, productive citizens in whatever form they're capable of doing. House File 1139 is a mental health bill that looks to help those who suffer with mental health issues and their families with the sustaining treatment for at least 1 year to help them become stable. With me today is former Representative Douglas Reuter. Is that how you pronounce it?
Reuter.
I keep wanting to pronounce that wrong. I apologize. Former Representative Douglas Reuter that has come to testify. And with that.
All right. And before we begin, Representative Keel, you have the DE1 amendment.
Oh, I'm sorry. And yes.
Representative Keel wishes to move the DE1 amendment to the amendment. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think with this, I'm going to let our testifier speak.
Okay, welcome to the committee, Mr. Reuter. You know the drill here. Please introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Doug Reuter, Douglas Reuter, former member, like I was introduced. And I know it's late, and I know you've been here all day, and it's deadline time, and I'm very familiar with it. But I do beg your indulgence because this bill deals with life and death. I would like to start out by just telling you why I'm here. My son in 2004 was diagnosed as a junior in college in Arizona as being bipolar. He also had a additional disease which 40% of bipolar sufferers have called anosognosia. What that means is he had absolutely no insight into his illness. So 60% of people with a bipolar mental illness have insight into their illness and 40% don't, approximately. The Arizona law allowed us to get our son into treatment quite easily, went through treatment, they got him stabilized, and as part of the law in Arizona back in 2004, when mentally ill people are court-ordered into treatment, when they are discharged from the hospital, they go through a process, and part of that process is they're required to stay on their medications for a year, and they're also required to go to a doctor or physician or
in some form be able to be checked to make sure they're still on their meds and still doing okay, and they have to do that every single week. If they don't, the court order that was issued when they were released, I'm sorry, when they were first hospitalized, means that they are rehospitalized. So Arizona did this first, and since then California has done it, although California modified it in from the point of view that they didn't want to force counties to have an unfunded mandate, so they allowed counties to opt into this program. To date, 17 counties covering 63% of the state of California are now covered by this. The state of New York incorporated this 10 years ago. My wife and I got a AOT, this bill, basically in its same form, passed in the state of Washington 2 years ago. So I'm not asking the state of Minnesota to be guinea pigs or do something that hasn't been tried. In fact, I believe there's 10 states that have this in place. So let me get back to my story of my son. After staying on his meds for a year, he continued on his meds for another half a year, and he thought, like most people do, at least once, twice, or three times that suffer from bipolar and schizophrenia, they believe they're cured, and he went off his meds. We got him rehospitalized, and again, after being stabilized and regulated on meds, he again had to go to a doctor every single week and stay on his meds for a year. He did that. He finished school, graduated, moved to the state of Washington in Seattle, where he stayed on his meds for 6 years, became a very productive member of society. He was a 28-year-old, six-figure salary computer programmer. And then in March of 2013, he went off his meds again after having been on them for 6 years. In the state of Washington, it was virtually impossible to get him hospitalized. That's not the case anymore because of laws that we got passed in 2015. And so he was in the hospital three different times over 3 months, costing close to $100,000 to the state of Washington. He was last discharged in late June of 2013, and on July 5th of 2013, our son got into an eight-hour-long standoff with the Seattle Police Department, at the end of which two snipers shot and killed our son. The difference, the only difference, is that in Arizona, he is required upon discharge from a hospital, court-ordered hospital stay, he was required to be on his meds for a year, which gave him time to heal. In Washington State, at the time, there was no such law. He was discharged three different times over a three-month period with absolutely no follow-up, none. No requirement to report to a doctor, no requirement to take meds. And as I said, he had anosognosia. He didn't believe he was sick. In fact, my son, one of his best friends, was a psych nurse at the Harborview Hospital, which is the main hospital where emergent cases of mental illness are taken in King County, the largest county in the state of Washington. He typed out all of his doctor's names, their phone numbers, every med that he's on, the exact dosage of the med, and he gave it to this nurse and said, if anything ever happens to me, please make sure I get my meds. He wanted to be sane. He wanted to be in his right mind. But when he went off his meds, it was absolutely impossible to convince him, as is most people with anosognosia, that he was sick. Even this mental health nurse who staged an 18-hour-long intervention trying to convince my son to go back on his meds failed. And so he ended up dead. So former Senator David Hahn came to our son's funeral in Eden Prairie. And after his funeral, David Hahn asked me if this could happen to someone in the state of Minnesota. I told him I didn't know. I'd been out of the legislature too long, but I told him I'd look into it. I did. It can happen in the state of Minnesota because the state of Minnesota has absolutely no requirement for any follow-up upon discharge from mental hospital where the treatment was court-ordered. None. So this absolute same thing can happen. And I think it's bad enough that in not only Minnesota, but in a lot of states, in fact, to my knowledge, all states except Arizona, the standard for getting someone in the hospital in the first place is a danger to themselves or others. It's not the case in Arizona, but it is the case in the state of Minnesota. And I'd probably close with this. I talked to Representative Bud Nornes when I first got up here almost 2 months ago now, and told me a horrifying story about one of his constituents. The parents knew that their son was mentally ill. He had been in the hospital before. They tried virtually the whole month of December to get him in the hospital, but he didn't meet the criteria of a danger to himself or others because he hadn't tried to kill himself or anyone else. 2 days after you were sworn in for this session, that young man killed his dad. Last Friday, he was found guilty. Second-degree murder. His wife has no husband, and her son's in jail for a very long time. So it's bad enough that we force people to get this sick before we get them help. If any one of you ever voted for a bill that said if you're diagnosed with cancer, you have to wait till you're in stage four to get treatment, it'd be your last session you're here. But that's how we treat mentally ill people. So what this bill does is it pretty much puts in place the Arizona model. If you are court-ordered into treatment upon discharge, you will be assigned a, caseworker, the title is slipping my mind right now. You'll be a case manager from the county. You will also, that case manager will sit down with the patient. They'll also sit down with the doctor, and the three of them will come together, and they will form a written treatment plan that will carry out for the next year. That treatment plan is taken to a judge. A judge accepts that, and the judge then orders it. It becomes an order. And so last night, this bill was heard in the Senate, and there were several opposition parties spoke, and I expect that to happen again tonight. But I did meet with one of them, the Minnesota Hospital Association, and I met today, and we have come to an agreement on some terms that they can speak to, but it satisfies most of their chief issue. We still haven't been able to reach an agreement with NAMI, but I'm still committed to try and do that if that's possible. But members, this is clearly life and death, and I strongly encourage you to give this serious consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bruder, for sharing your story with us tonight and for your advocacy on behalf of your own experiences and what you've seen and what you don't want other people to have to experience here. I would like to get the DE1 adopted briefly, and then we can go into member questions and other testimony. Are there any technical questions to DE1? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The DE1 is adopted. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keel, thank you for carrying this bill. It's a difficult one, and I really enjoyed the conversation with Mr. Reuter in your office. Again, I'm terribly sorry about your son, and I guess I have some questions just about, as you were explaining it to me, what other states were doing and how we rehospitalize somebody in those states, and in actually the state of mind. Help me understand, is it law enforcement that has to actually sort of rehospitalize them if they're in that position? Is it an ambulance? Is it a family member? Help me just visualize what it's like to take someone like your son back to the hospital when maybe they really don't want to go. Is it almost a law enforcement type of thing? Could you help me with that, please?
Mr. Reuter.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, in my son's case, it was police involvement, handcuffed and taken under duress.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Baker.
That's it. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions right now for Mr. Reuter? Hearing none, we'll move into public testimony. I think there's a few folks who want to testify on the bill. If they could start making their way down, they can introduce themselves and present their testimony in whichever order they prefer.
Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Sue Abholden, Executive Director of NOWNY, Minnesota. And I do want to again thank former Representative Reuter for sharing his story and again say how sorry I am for his loss. His story is a familiar one to me and to NAMI. Every day we hear from families struggling to help their loved ones access treatment at the right time and the right place. This is why NAMI comes to the legislature with so many bills every year, because we know firsthand the barriers and problems as we work to build our mental health system. The NAMI Legislative Committee and Board, which is comprised nearly 100% of people living with a mental illness and their family members, decided not to support the bill at this time. There are simply too many problems with the language in the bill. For those of you who are newer, you need to know that changing the Commitment Act is not easy because there are so many interests involved. There are police, mobile crisis teams, emergency departments, hospitals, counties, attorneys, pre-petition screening teams, county attorneys, judges, state-operated programs, community providers, mental health professionals, and, of course, people with mental illnesses and their families. There are simply a lot of people who have a stake in and are impacted by how the Commitment Act has changed. NAMI agrees that changes are needed, especially for individuals who have anexignosia and for those who are in a constant cycle of being committed, receiving treatment, ending the commitment, and then stop taking their medications and treatment and decompensate only to be committed again. But this small group is not the entire group of people who are committed. There are over 4,000 people committed every year, and for many, it will be their first and last time. In 2015, the legislature passed a bill. Representative Hoppe was the author in the House that made changes to the mentally ill and dangerous section of the Commitment Act. These changes were the result of a work group of stakeholders who met and came to an agreement on changes, and it sailed through the legislature. Because we met outside of the session and had time to talk through the issues and the changes. This bill and this amendment until recently had not been discussed with the stakeholders such as mental health advocates, hospitals, counties, or attorneys. I'd like to walk through the key problems that we have with the bill as amended. On page 2, there's a requirement that someone who has missed one appointment or doesn't substantially comply with the treatment plan must be admitted to the hospital. It's very likely that they do not meet that level of care or medical necessity for hospitalization, especially after missing one appointment. We already have a problem with over 20% of people with mental illness waiting in the hospital for community care or in ERTS or in OCA. And so why would we require a hospital to admit them even without determining if they needed that level of care?
Yeah,
if the treating facility was an OCA, how do they get back in? I'm going to talk about that. Don't worry.
No. They're not following you because I think you're talking about the Senate copy, not
now. Oh, I am talking about the Senate amendment. Sorry. But it should be pretty similar, isn't it? Oh, it's just a different one. Yeah. Okay. You know, even if you don't require someone to go back into the hospital and just be assessed in the emergency room, which is one of the issues being talked about, we already have backups in the emergency room. The length of commitment is being, sorry about this. The length of the commitment is being added on. It's now a 6-month commitment, so you'd be adding on an additional year. And again, there's no targeting of this extension. It's for everyone who's been committed. And again, that's over 4,000 people a year. We don't know how this will work if someone has a provisional discharge. We have a lot of people who agree to provisional discharge and agree to continue to get treatment in the community. The individual treatment plan, in a way, is not individualized because it's being required that there be a weekly appointment with a psychiatrist, a nurse practitioner, doctor, a psychologist. And again, this is for everyone. Not only do we not have the workforce to meet this requirement, but not everyone needs that type of interaction. This list does not include every type of mental health professional. It doesn't include peer specialists who could be very helpful in engaging someone in treatment. There are no variations if the person has an injectable antipsychotic, so maybe they're receiving a shot once a week or once a month. And how does this work if someone has an assertive community treatment team or weekly armed services, is on a CADI waiver where they have frequent contact with a mental health professional or practitioner, and what if they're a member of a clubhouse and go there daily? Verifying someone's medication can be difficult because there's not a blood test for all medications. And there's no leeway for missing an appointment. What if someone is sick, misses the bus, couldn't get off of work, and my understanding is the professional would notify the police to have them picked up. NAMI certainly understands the need for early intervention treatment, but this bill doesn't do that. NAMI understands the need for engaging and supporting people who cycle in and out of the hospital and experience multiple commitments. But what happens when the 18-month period is over? How do we keep them engaged in treatment and in recovery beyond that stage? We agree that it's time to reexamine the commitment laws, but we believe the best way to do that is to bring everyone together. This is why we have worked with Representative O'Neill to introduce a bill this week that will recreate the 1996 task force that looked at and made recommendations for changes to the Commitment Act. There are many things that need to be looked at in the Commitment Act because we have very different services available today than we did that back then. There are also many things that can be done to engage people with the most serious mental illnesses. First episode programs, supportive housing, ACT teams, easier access to injectables, antipsychotics, and I can tell you we have a problem with prior authorization, and using more effective strategies around medication adherence. This bill, while trying to address a real issue, has language that is not workable right now, and there will be a cost to our human services, healthcare, and judicial systems. Stakeholder involvement is key to getting a bill passed that changes the Commitment Act. NAMI does not oppose this bill lightly. You know we take these issues very seriously, but we can't simply support it at this time. Words matter. The last time the legislature passed a change with an absolute about what had to happen under the commitment law, we got the 48-hour law. And as you know, that created a lot of problems and unintended consequences. As you know, this issue, when it comes to mental health, is not a partisan issue. We have had support across both parties. And unfortunately, this bill is just it's not at the right point now. We need to treat people differently. All those 4,000 people that we commit every year have to be treated on a very individual basis based on what they really need and based on their options and hope for recovery. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Abderholden, for your testimony. Questions for Ms. Abderholden, Representative Liebling.
So thank you, Ms. Abderholden, and thank you, Mr. Bruder, I hope I'm saying it right, for your testimony on this. And, you know, Ms. Abderholden, I get it, and I think, you know, thank you for pointing out some of the problems. I think the real issue remains, though, for a small number of people for whom this really could make a real difference, to be continuously under some control, for lack of a better word, that it sounds like there's really room here for us to make some progress in this area. Now, maybe not tonight. Mm-hmm. I take that point. But I think that the whole idea of keeping some structure around someone, obviously it needs to be a much more individualized structure. But would there be a way in your mind to change the Commitment Act to allow a court to make a very individualized plan for somebody? One of the things that bothered me about this language as I looked at it was that there doesn't seem to be any recourse for the person if the stuff is wrong. You know, once you, under this language, once the mentally ill person was, you know, what if they just disagree or what if there's some change? Or there's no real due process aspect to it once you would be under this scheme. But wouldn't it be possible to write some change into the law that would allow a court to make a really individualized plan for somebody where we know, and I don't dare try to say the word that you used about when somebody doesn't know they're ill, but, I mean, that is, if that's 40% of the people with bipolar, for example, that is part of the commitment, there would be a determination about, you know, what the person will need upon release and what resources are available and all of those things so that it can be an order that actually fits their particular situation rather than something as general as what's in this bill.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, we actually have that option under the commitment law now. You can extend the commitment for an additional year at the end of those 6 months, and that does happen. We have, you know, I have board members where that has happened to their son or daughter. So that does exist, and they're, you know, and they develop the treatment plan and whatever needs to happen with that. But it doesn't say that automatically after 6 months you get an additional year and you need to meet with someone weekly. But you can extend that commitment order an additional year.
And Mr.
Liebling.
Thank you. But Ms. Abderholden, is that commitment that you can do now, does it allow you to have sort of commitment in the community, and does it allow the court to tailor the conditions to the real needs of that person so that, you know, I get it, you know, maybe it isn't every week, maybe it isn't, you know, and it does bother me, the idea that the person would be arrested by the police and all of that, you know, we're kind of creating an involvement with law enforcement right there, but just the general point that he's trying to make. Do we have that now, or do we really need to do something to give courts more flexibility to be able to tailor a program to a person's needs?
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I know now that people don't often always spend the entire 6 months in a hospital or at ANOCA or even an IRTS facility. So we do have people who are committed to the community. I have, you know, a number of, again, people that I've worked with very closely at NAMI where that has happened to their son, and one in particular. Frankly, he's recommitted pretty much all the time because he has very serious schizophrenia and his delusions never really go away. So it is a possibility now. We do have an early intervention law that has a different standard than our current commitment law. The problem has come in actually implementing it because of the court process. By the time it actually kind of gets through, the person actually meets the regular commitment law. And I will mention our commitment law also, it has a third prong to it if someone is not able to care for themselves. It's not just danger to themselves or others.
Mm-hmm. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Ms. Abderholden? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Abderholden, did you, prior to testifying, work with or contact Mr. Reuter in regards to his bill, knowing that the situation well? I mean, you were an expert in the field, no doubt, and we look to you for advice. Were you able to connect with him and offer your expertise to him and maybe make the bill better or give him some advice?
Ms. Abderholden.
Or vice versa. He also is an expert as well, having such a personal connection to it with the death of his son. So emotionally, he probably is even more attached to it. So it works both ways.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Abderholden.
Representative McDonald. So we saw the Senate delete all language on Friday. It was posted on Friday. We talked briefly before the hearing. I think we have a fundamental difference in believing that everyone who is committed needs that additional year. And I guess my experience in working with a lot of people with mental illness over the last, you know, more than 15 years is that there are people who truly, I mean, I hire them, they truly get better after that first 6 months. You know, they maybe were hospitalized, they get on medication, and they're fine, and they never come back to the commitment court, that they really are working and being in recovery. So I think just adding that additional year when someone might not need it is a cost to our system to do that, and it's difficult for them because, again, you're under a court order, which can make it very difficult for someone, especially if they really don't need that.
Representative McDonald.
And well, I appreciate that answer and your expert testimony, and I'm sure the committee does as well, with your sharing of some members that have joined your team. Did you connect with Mr. Reuter and just sharing some of your concerns prior to knowing the importance of it? Were you able to do that?
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, you know, this has been moving pretty fast. I mean, we've, you know, found out, you know, about the hearing. And I think, as many of you know, I've had quite a few bills up in both the House and the Senate the last 2 days. So other than meeting right before this meeting, no, we have not.
Representative McDonald.
I get that. I know how fast it moves here. So thank you, Ms. Andrew.
All right. Any other? Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to kind of follow up on Representative Liebling's questions, you know, I guess I understand, too, that all 4,000 people may not need this, that, you know, some of them can have it extended for a year, but it seems to me like there are certain situations, and I get certainly the concerns raised about getting law enforcement involved, but, you know, I've dealt with a couple situations with people who have been committed, and I can very easily see a situation where you might need to get law enforcement involved. Say a person's commitment period is over. When they leave it, they appear to be doing okay, taking their medication, but then shortly thereafter go off of it. You know, is there sort of a change in law needed to address those situations, kind of along the lines of what Mr. Reuter was explaining? I think Representative Liebling was asking that question, but I didn't really hear an answer to that specific part of it.
Ms. Everholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Freeberg. So a couple things. I mean, there are definitely things that we need to change in the Commitment Act. I actually think our early intervention law, while written well before I actually came to NAMI, we're not implementing it, and so we need to be meeting with the county attorneys to figure out why. What we hear most in terms of the calls to our office, you know, calls to me on at night and the weekends, because everyone knows my cell phone number, is really more around when someone, you know, even if they've been on commitment, they have that additional year, it's that time later when they start decompensating. When someone has that cycle of being able to do it and being able to bring them in early and not before they really meet, you know, where they're in danger to themselves or others and can't care for themselves. That is the biggest issue that we see, because sometimes someone will do well for 2 years, maybe 3 years, and then we see that happen. And so that is a larger issue, frankly, for us, is how, when someone has that pattern, how do we get to intervene early at the beginning of when they're decompensating, and not way at the end when they've really gone into a full-blown crisis.
Representative Freiberg.
But what do you do at the end when they go into a full-blown crisis? Because it does happen sometimes.
Ms. Everholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Freiberg, and that's when, you know, the mobile crisis team might come out, do an assessment. It might be that they'd be put on a transport hold and be brought to the emergency room where they decide whether they need hospital level of care, or could they be served in a crisis home or somewhere else. So that is what happens. But we want to, again, try to get ahead of that, especially when there's a pattern. You know, we have some people, you know, especially with anexignosia, yeah, there can be a real pattern there over the years, over the course of their lifetime, and we don't want to have to wait until they get into a full-blown crisis.
Representative Freiberg, any other questions for Ms. Everholden? Seeing none, Ms. Everholden, committee thanks you for your testimony this evening. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good evening. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rochelle Westland, and I am the Health and Human Services Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I'm here tonight just to briefly touch on concerns with this bill. While we understand that there is a mental health crisis in the state of Minnesota, and counties feel that very acutely, we want individuals to be successful, and we want them to be supportive. But as stated even by supporters of this bill really is an unfunded mandate to counties. The requirement for county case managers to give this type of attention to cases, to this number of cases, is going to require a dramatic increase in staff for counties statewide. We want this mental health system to be one that works. We want it to be able to be one that is accessible to people. However, we are very concerned that when we're building this mental health system and the supports that go with it, that it's being built on the backs of county property tax dollars, and would be asking for this committee to consider including state investment into this bill.
All right. Questions for Ms. Westland? Seeing none, Ms. Westland, the committee thanks you for your testimony this evening.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kristen Long, Rachel from Minnesota Hospital Association and our 142 member hospitals from around the state. I would like to share some of our concerns with you regarding House File 1139. You know, this is well-intentioned, and we recognize the goal of this legislation to keep people that are suffering from mental illness on their medications. Care coordination is so important to so many conditions. But we are concerned about the requirement that a person be automatically admitted into a hospital upon failure to participate in a weekly treatment appointment or for taking their medications. This legislation removes a hospital physician's clinical judgment from the decision about whether a person needs to be admitted and would require services to be provided on an inpatient basis by an already very stressed mental health system. On average, Minnesota hospitals care for 1,077 mental health inpatients every day. Individual hospitals with inpatient mental health units have an average occupancy rate of well over 80%. Our Twin Cities hospitals are approaching 90% occupancy rates, and the hospitals outside the metro area have a 77% occupancy rate. We also have concerns about how this legislation is going to interact with the 48-hour law, giving preference to law enforcement and the placement of patients into our state-operated mental health beds at either Anoka or the community behavioral health hospitals. If a patient presents at the emergency department, they will be triaged and they will wait for a bed. Once a bed opens up at one of our hospitals with an inpatient unit. And I know that you've heard testimony on other bills that wait can be very long. You know, we have reports of patients boarding in our emergency departments for weeks, waiting for beds at an inpatient unit. You know, we do appreciate our conversation that we had this afternoon with Mr. Reuter and to, you know, address our concerns and talk through our concerns about the automatic admittance into a hospital. And we appreciate every dollar that this legislature and the governor have appropriated and invested into our mental health system, but there's so much more work to be done. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lockridge, for your testimony this evening. Any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, the committee thanks you. All right. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you. Shannon Mulville, Executive Director with Mental Health Minnesota and co-chair of the Mental Health Legislative Network. I also do appreciate the goal of trying to get more people the help that they need before they get too sick. However, mental health commitment is a very serious issue and one that a lot of people in this state have a real stake in. I'm not going to repeat a lot of the concerns that Sue expressed because there's no need to do that. I do want to raise just a couple of things that I thought about when I read this. The first is that the bill would require mental health providers to notify law enforcement if someone misses an appointment. And, you know, my gut reaction was that would certainly make a big dent in a therapeutic relationship and an ability of a client to trust someone moving forward if that were to happen. I'm also concerned that it does tend to make an assumption that if someone misses an appointment, that it's because they're not interested in complying or interested in getting better. In fact, we get calls every week from people who miss appointments because they don't have adequate transportation, they don't have stable housing, they don't have supportive networks to help them get there. The Mental Health Legislative Network does believe that any changes to the commitment law should occur in a really inclusive process that involves a lot of stakeholders. My personal opinion is we need to make sure that we're also hearing from people with a lived mental health experience as part of that. And this bill would make substantial changes to the commitment law without that type of process, so we don't support it at this time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Mulvihill, for your testimony this evening. Are there questions for Ms. Mulvihill? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this evening. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1139? Seeing none, we'll move to members' questions.
Mr. Chairman, could I I'd like to respond to just a couple of things that were said. So one of the things, when I was a member, one of the things I hated was unfunded mandates. I think if you check my voting record, it's probably pretty solid that I didn't vote for very many. But I'd like to just quote current state law in Minnesota. It's 245.4711, Case Management Services. By January 1st, 1989, the county board shall provide case management services for all adults with serious and persistent mental illness. This county mandate has been in place since 1989. Counties know exactly what they need to do when they're talking about serious mental illness and getting case managers involved. One of the things that the bill does is it brings that case manager together, as I said earlier, with the patient, and the patient by this time is ready for discharge. That patient has been regulated on their meds, they've been balanced, they're of sound mind, and they sit down with the case manager and their own doctor, and they develop their own plan. It is absolutely individualized. They agree to that plan in writing. If they violate that plan, that's when the bill kicks in. The other thing I'd like to quote you, I'd like to read to you, is the we talked about and have heard about court-ordered early intervention. Early intervention, the reason it's not being used is because it has the same standard as a 72-hour hold. You have to be a danger to yourself or others. Senator Dan Hall has a bill, Senate File 691, that lowers that standard and, in my personal opinion, should be applied to the Early Intervention Act. But let me just read this. If the court orders early intervention, the court may include in its order a variety of treatment alternatives, including but not limited to day treatment, medication compliance monitoring, which is exactly what I've got in this bill, assertive community treatment, crisis assessment and stabilization, partial hospitalization, and short-term hospitalization. If the court, this is existing law, if the court orders short-term hospitalization and the proposed patient will not go voluntarily, the court may direct a health officer, peace officer, or other person to take the person into custody and transport the person to the hospital. If that's a concern in the bill before you tonight, then I suggest someone make a motion to repeal this bill. If you're not gonna stand for people when they're so sick that they can't be transported safely other than with a police officer, if that's a problem in my bill, then it's a problem in the early intervention bill too, because that's exactly how those people are transported when they refuse to comply with a court order. And like I said, I'm not asking the Minnesota legislature to do something that's never been done anywhere. There's at least 10 states that have this in law: California, Arizona, Nevada, Montana, North Carolina, Ohio, New York, Washington. They can't all be wrong. They can't all be wrong. They're saving lives. And my son is the absolute proof. When he was on a plan where he was required to stay on his meds, he was fine. As soon as he got to a state that wasn't required to stay on his meds after discharge, he decompensated 3 times in 3 months. The total bill of the state of Washington for my son's 3 month hospitalization and death was over $500,000. How do you put that in a fiscal note? There's going to be a fiscal note on this bill. How does this, that's just one person. That's just one person. You can't account for those kinds of things. If you don't treat mental illness seriously and take the most seriously mental ill people and make sure that they're staying on their meds, especially the ones that don't even know they're sick and you can't possibly convince them that they're sick, there's going to end in catastrophe. I'd stand for questions.
All right, questions from members. Representative Murphy. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this was really for the author. And thank you very much, Mr. Reuter, for your presentation. And obviously, this is a really, really tough issue. And my question to Representative Keel is there a, you know, I think it's really, you know, personally, I'll have a lot of trouble passing this bill along tonight because I know it's going to another committee, but I think the issues really need to be resolved in the Health Committee first before they would go to public safety. But I'm very sympathetic to the testifier, and I think most of us are really concerned about the problem and want to do something, want to make sure that this is being handled. So my question to you is whether leaving here, whether there's a, whether you see a place where the stakeholders can come together around this. And I know Ms. Abderholden talked about the Commitment Act and all the people involved. And I don't want to be, we all hate it when it seems like our job is just to say no. I don't think we want to just say no. But I feel like I want to know that the problem doesn't just get sort of dropped and forgotten if the bill doesn't make it through. I really don't feel like the bill language is ready to go. At the same time, I don't, you know, it's just, you know where I'm going. It's a difficult problem, I think, for us as a committee, I suspect. And I bet other members feel like I do, too, that we feel kind of torn. We don't want to just pass it along, and we don't want to let the problem go unaddressed. So I'm kind of putting it on you, the author, of how you would suggest to us that we could go forward with trying to search out some solutions that bring together the stakeholders in a more, you know, a more appropriate forum.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. I understand what you're saying, and as we work on this more and more, I understand that there are a lot of stakeholders that we need to work with, and certainly the intent is to help people. And just the discussion I've had in the last 3-4 days about this and the thought process of working with it, unfortunately, we have very short time to get through these things. I think there's some conversations. I think there's some conversations we need to have with all of the groups and talk about what it is we can do. Maybe there is something we can do, maybe not all of it, and we certainly want to work on whatever it is that's possible, because the answer isn't just to wait. We're soon going to hear about someone else, like the Fergus Falls case, and certainly Mr. Reuter's case. It is just very tragic to see someone die, whether they do it at their own hands because they're confused and have a mental illness or because they take family away. And it's a very tragic situation. I would like to say we can get this all, you know, and maybe we can. I'm optimistic. A little hard work. We'll see where we can go with it, and maybe we have to work on it even longer. But I certainly would like to try and see what we can do.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Keel. You know, would you consider laying the bill over so that you could work on it some more? I'm not really understanding what your intention is, just to pass it out of here tonight and then keep working on it. I have to say, I don't feel comfortable doing that, but I also don't want to vote no. I'd really like to see you, and I know there isn't a lot of time, but, you know, sometimes things can be accomplished, too, not necessarily by changing law always, mm-hmm. but I agree there's some urgency. There always is, and we're taking other steps. We've been taking other steps in our whole mental health system. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, you know, maybe that would be a solution to lay the bill over it or just to, I don't know if there's, can be sort of continued on the committee's agenda so that you could do some more work on the bill and maybe come back with another iteration of some of this language.
Representative Keel.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would ask you, is it possible to lay it over and bring it back and work on it between now? And then my other question is, do I understand that it still needs to get through public safety by the 10th of March?
Representative Keel, Representative Liebling, I believe the motion for that would be to lay the bill on the table when we were ready, and then when we were ready to bring the bill back up, we would just pull it back up from the table and probably announce ahead of time the date that we were intending to do that so we had appropriate testimony with that. That said, we have 5 hearing days left for this committee, and last I checked, about 3,000 bills introduced into this committee for consideration. So it's your call, but we can do that. Representative Keel, do you know what the process in the Senate is on this one?
I believe it was passed on with
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Ritter.
It was referred to Judiciary last night, and so it's sitting in Senator Limmer's committee. And then it will have to go to Finance.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
But they did pass it out last night.
Chair Dean.
Mr. Chair, I would make the recommendation that we pass it from this committee on to public safety on a voice vote today and have the stakeholders continue to work together. And we'll also have to come back to Health and Human Services Finance, and would just want to encourage the author and to keep moving the bill forward and to keep working with the stakeholders. And then most of the folks here will also be all on the Finance Committee and would be willing to work with anyone else here who would like to circle back with the bill.
All right. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, I think I was kind of going to circle back a little bit what Representative Liebling was saying, and sort of this is a good concept of an idea that we need to address more. I think what was disappointing for me tonight was that I didn't hear a lot of enthusiasm from the folks that were opposing the bill to say they're willing to work with the author and with the other folks. That was disappointing to me, and I'm sorry, because we have a really great state for mental health. And I'm pretty proud of what Minnesota is and where we're at. Now, there's a few other things that Mr. Werder has seen around other states in our country that they're doing some things better. But I will tell you, for the most part, Minnesota is a pretty good state when it comes to mental health support. But we have work to do on that. And you do have a good bill. And, Dad, thanks, Representative Keel, thanks for carrying this bill. If the chairs think that we should pass it and work on it, that's fine. It's certainly not ready for public safety. But it needs a lot of work, and I want to support the journey it's on. It may not make this session at all. But a lot of good bills take a lot of time to make it, and former representative, you know that already. I think that this takes some time and a lot of thought. So, you know, if we do pass it tonight, I think, and Chair Dean has a good point in that, if we get it through here, it's got a lot of work to do. But I think it shows the statement to our folks also in mental health that testified tonight that we also as a committee see this as an important deal. I would suggest that we try to do that, and then we really get busy trying to work on it. And let's not be too disappointed if we don't get it through this year because of the deadlines. But thank you again for bringing this forward.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. Listening to the testimony tonight, it seemed pretty evident there's a desire for a range of options for post-discharge so that depending on what the individual is involved with, to be able to have those contacts per week. And so if you worked with the stakeholders for a range of options for that, as long as you can be assured that somebody with some knowledge and skill interacts with that person on a regular basis, I think you might be able to find comfort on the other side of that. If there was an option for noncompliance up to, recommitting, and because the statute makes it pretty evident that someone who especially has a history of risk to themselves and others who is showing a trend or escalation towards that again, there may be some language that would allow for that process to be triggered slightly quicker than for someone who had no past history. And so if you look at those two options and options, you might be able to find common ground and make this work. And that's what I hope, because frankly, this is something we need to try and make work. And thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Just quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair, to reiterate what Chair Dean said. What I've learned in the short 7 years is that's what the committee process is for, especially in this late of the game. You don't lay something over for the fear that it may not even come back. But the idea of a bill is to get it further away from passing law. That's why it goes through so many committees, because you have the expertise of those stakeholders that are out in the audience and the expert, or lack thereof, members here at the various committees to work on it through each committee. So as a bill goes through several different committees, hearings, that's the idea. You don't lay something over. You perfect it, pass it, go to the next committee. So it defeats the purpose of really how a law becomes a bill if we lay it over tonight, Representative Keel. So my suggestion is to follow what we do best here and how a bill becomes a law. You pass it on a committee, and you perfect it and bring it to the next committee, and those experts add to it with an amendment to the author and to the next committee, and hopefully comes on the House floor and a law. So that's my 2 cents.
Thank you.
Representative Freiberg.
I guess we're kind of getting into a discussion about procedure here, but you know, I do feel like, you know, we heard Ms. Abderholden say that the civil commitment process needs to be revised. It does sound like there's an issue, but you know, just the more I think about it, the way it's set up, you know, kind of mandating a specific treatment here, I'm not really comfortable supporting this. At one point, I feel like, you know, as the health committee, a lot of the issues are that are still need to be worked on here are health related. So I, you know, I don't really want to vote against it, but I don't feel like it's really ready to be passed on. So I don't feel like I will be supporting this at this point.
All right. Are there any other questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess in the spirit of this, if we're having the discussion about process, and this is the opportunity to work on improving the bill in committee process, then I guess I had a question earlier, and I'll raise it. And this is, and it was brought up around, I read this right away, and the trust issue that I think one of the testifiers hit right away was right where I went with this, around mental health and working at a frontline service provider with folks who are homeless and struggling with mental health and chemical dependency and a number of things, and watching as we built relationships with law enforcement and things. And to the testifier, I think it was actually helpful when you read some clarifying language around how it was worded in the piece that you're talking about. In this bill, it specifically talks about a peace officer, and it talks about missing one appointment, which really makes it pretty stringent. And so my question is, why wouldn't we talk more about some frontline, the crisis interventions teams? You know, why was it worded really tightly around the police officer part, and specifically adding that piece in about missing just one appointment? Some tension around that piece in particular, if you could explain why it's specific like this.
Mr. Reuter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative. The best thing to do is relate to you the experience. When someone is severely mentally ill and they're off their meds and they don't believe they're mentally ill, very few times in my experience and all the people that we have gotten to know over the last 4 years since our son's death and our lobbying efforts in Washington, very few people go peacefully because they literally don't believe they're sick. And they get very agitated. And what the purpose for this is, even severely mentally ill people do not like mental hospitals. Even our son, when he got out, said, I am never going back there again. I will do whatever I need to do to not go back there again. It is the stick. So we got the carrot and the stick. You got the carrot. And I keep hearing it, Representative, you're saying that this is like a one plan fits all. It literally is every single plan is an individual plan. It's worked out between the caseworker and the mentally ill person and their doctor. and then they all sign off on it, and the court gives it their blessing and turns it into a court order. So I think I just, you know, when we're looking at safety of society, when you have a severely mentally ill person, there is no telling. I can tell you, I didn't share this in the other committee, I'll tell you this. Every single night for 6 weeks at 2:30 in the morning on the dot, our son called our home. We always took his call because we were trying to find a way to get to him. And every single night for 6 weeks, he threatened to get on an airplane and come home and kill us. Do you think that person is going to go willingly to a hospital? It isn't going to happen. And the last time that a judge ordered our son released from the hospital, the Seattle Police Department, in an extremely rare move, went and testified at that hearing and begged the court not to release our son. But they did anyway, and then the court sealed all the records so that no one could see what judge ordered that. 10 days later, our son was dead. To try and expect, it'd be really nice if people would just say, okay, yeah, I'm sick and I need to go to the hospital. When you're severely mentally ill and you have anosognosia, that doesn't happen. I have two friends in this state have bipolar mental illness. They do not have anosognosia. Trust me, I've sat up many, many nights with one of them trying to get him through suicide thoughts. But when that man, he's been bipolar for 50 years, when that man wakes up in the morning, he knows whether his meds are out of balance or not. And the first thing he does is calls his doctor. That's completely opposite with, that someone does with anosognosia. I'm telling you, you cannot convince these people that they're ill. And they can and they are dangerous. And so, yeah, I don't have a problem with having, it's already in your law. It's already in your early intervention law. They use police officers to bring these people in. Because why? They've met the threshold finally. They are a danger to themselves or others. You're not going to send a caseworker out there when they're a danger to themselves or others. And I don't know if that answers your question, Representative.
Representative Olson.
I mean, I get it, to your point, and I, you know, hear the pain in that and understand that, that there is a time and a place for the police officer piece of this, absolutely. But I think this just broadens it so much that it scares me with the unintended consequences for those folks that don't need that police intervention. And so that's the part that the rub for me around folks that may miss a meeting and not be a danger to, I think, Ms. Abnerhol's part about, like, she's hired some folks who have at one point been committed and been down this process that there are folks that may miss a meeting, may miss an appointment and don't need that police intervention. And just when you start to bring in more law enforcement interactions between folks with mental health, and you know, there's just some things that can start to happen that are dangerous and scare me a little bit in the unintended consequence, not to the point that you're bringing out specifically to your case, but broader. And I think our job here as a committee is really to think about the larger implications of the legislation we move. And so that's just the concern I raise around this part, hearing exactly what you're saying, but I think there's just some broader concerns that I just wanted to raise if we're moving this forward in the spirit of still wanting to make sure that we can have necessary interventions in situations like the ones you're talking about.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Ritter,
Representative, so this is why the committee process is so good, and so that I can fully understand what you mean and what would make you comfortable, you would like all reference to police officers removed, or would you like language that says a court may? I think, doesn't it say may? So if we're gonna try and work with all the stakeholders as this bill moves along, I think you have a very, obviously we're hearing it from several people. This is very helpful. So could I ask you What is the issue with the police? Do you want the police totally removed from this bill altogether?
Representative Olson.
That's a great point. And I would actually, I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on all processes related to mental health. I'm just raising some concerns and would love to hear more, you know, in this process to have this continue to be worked even, you know, outside of this room and whatnot, too, around processes. I know there's crisis intervention teams. There's other elements, too. So I'm just raising that up as a possibility for improvement in there.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Keel, Mr. Reuter, this is a tough piece of legislation with a lot of implications for the health of individuals, their civil rights, the health care delivery system. Mr. Reuter, you came and visited with me, so we already knew that. I hope that, Representative Keel, as you work through this, that you do it with the diligence that you are describing. And I hope before it comes to Health and Human Services Finance that the stakeholders take seriously the proposal, because if it comes, you know, to that next committee where we have to vote again on the health care provisions and it's in inadequate order, then I don't think it's going to see the light of day to the end of the session. And the question that's being raised for us is a serious one, and you picked a hard bill.
But she's good at it.
Yeah, no doubt. That's not my point. I don't mean it as a challenge, but instead a request for your attention and the attention of the stakeholders to get it right if this is going to move forward this session.
All right. Any other questions for the bill author? Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Keel, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. We know that there's an issue with mental health, and I really hold tightly to a passionate parent who comes up with solutions on what's wrong and what should work. I think there's great value in it. We've seen it over and over again, not only in our nation but in our state as well. I think we should take these provisions, these considerations very highly. And I hope with working with the shareholders that we don't lose the spirit, the intent, and what you feel is the best way to do it. If we had more parents lined up, I would almost think they'd be saying the same thing you are. I remember when I was a young girl, the last time I saw my grandmother, whom I found out later was schizophrenic, the last time I saw her was going to the hospital. I was sitting in the front seat with my grandfather, and my grandmother was in the back with my mom, and my grandmother was fighting my mom so she could braid my hair, which was shorter than it is now. That's my last memory. You know, and that was in 1969, and sometimes I wonder, okay, maybe 1970, sometimes I wonder if we've gotten much further than that. You know, are we just missing a lot of things and we're too afraid we're being nice? I mean, if we need to call our peace officers in who do training on how to handle these types of things, you know, if we're just going to be Mr. Nice Guy, are we going to save a life? Or are we just going to feel like we were Mr. Nice Guy? I really hope that we go forward with this. I hope that we do work and do the work that needs to get done. But I also hope that we keep the bill true to its spirit and intent, and we don't water it down so that we feel better about it. I would rather save a life than feel better. Thank you for doing this.
All right. Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Keel, final word.
Mr. Chair, I would appreciate if we did pass this on to public safety. I will take all of the messages that were said here tonight and certainly work on the issues at hand. I want to remind people that law officers are often called. That's who does this. And in my own district, and I'm going to go back and ask again, they have told me many times that there's a real problem. They have no place to go. There's no place to take them. And so they bring them to jail because they have to calm them down and say protect the public. I just think we need to have the conversation in public safety. I'm glad we are, you know, we'll bring it back to Health and Human Services Finance, and hopefully by then we can work out much of the concerns that everyone has, and we'll work with them. So with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate everyone's support.
With that, Representative Keel renews her motion that House File 1139 as amended, be referred to the Committee of Public Safety. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 1139, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Public Safety. Thank you, Representative Keel. With that, members, we have no further bills. We are taking committee time tomorrow, so we will be back in room 200 in 11 hours and 45 minutes. We'll see you then. We are adjourned.